You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I'm Fiona Hill, the director of the Center in the United States and Europe, and I'm really delighted to have an extraordinary panel with us today of expertise to cover the whole range of issues related to the elections. And I do hope that you will all stay on also for the second panel, which is going to take a broader look beyond Ukraine itself at the future of the relationships with Europe and the Eastern Partnership Programme and the European Neighbourhood Policy, which was one of the triggers for the whole series of events in Ukraine over the last several months. So we have four panellists with us today. You have the bios for all of them. And because we've started just a few minutes late, I don't want to go into all of the details. You can consult the biographical material. But needless to say, all four of them are real experts on the topics that they're going to be presenting to you today. And also have some really genuine, very interesting practical experience on these issues. We have immediately to my left Adrian Camazin from the Voice of America, who is going to begin with an overview for us of the elections and the results, what kind of coalition might now emerge in the Ukrainian parliament, and what this might mean politically in terms of the parliament's ability and readiness to work with the recently elected Ukrainian President Poroshenko. After Adrian, we have Anders Aslund, who all of you here know as our colleague from across the street at the Peterson Institute and someone who has been looking at the Ukrainian economy from all kinds of different directions, including working with a number of Ukrainian policymakers for many years on the topic of Ukrainian economic reform. And Anders is going to talk about the key economic challenges that Ukraine faces, and what the likelihood, of course, is of the new Ukrainian parliament, the Rada, being able to tackle the reforms. Anders has been working on this for such a long time that he knows this all very intimately, and I'm sure it can also give us something of a perspective of the attempts at reform in Ukraine in the past. And then we're also delighted to have with us Lilia Shevtsova from the Carnegie Moscow Center. Lilia, again, needs no introduction to everyone here. You all know of her and her many books on Russia, and on her continuous writings on issues of contemporary Russian politics and foreign policy. And Ilya is going to discuss how this election is likely to be viewed from Moscow and some of the general points about Russia's approach to Ukraine, obviously one of the major issues in the Ukrainian set of relationships today. And then we'll end with Stephen Pfeiffer, who again, all of you know from here at Brookings, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, who's going to talk about the broader perspective on the Ukrainian elections from the United States and Europe and how Western support is likely to play out in this aftermath of the parliamentary elections. And then that will lead seamlessly, we hope, into the second panel where we have another set of distinguished guests who will talk about this broader implications. So without any further ado, I'll hand it over to Adrian, and then we'll hand off to Anders, Lilia, and Steve, and then hopefully we will leave sufficient time to have a discussion with you in the audience. And thank you again for everyone for joining us. Adrian.
Thank you, Fiona. So as the federal employee in the group here, I need to mention that my viewpoints that I express are, of course, my own. Well, with 29 parties that were on the ballot this year and 6,500 candidates that ran for office, Ukrainians can't be accused of making life simple for the voters. Kind of going over a nuts and bolts kind of overview of the vote and the parliament. Ukraine's parliament, of course, is unicameral. It's 450 seats. To fill half of those seats, Ukrainians voters chose their favorite party from a list of 29 parties. And to fill the remaining seats, Ukrainians voted for a candidate to represent their district in parliament. So normally that would be 225 districts, but this year there were only 198 seats. That's because voting could not take place in Crimea or the parts of the Donbas region that are not under Ukrainian government control. So this parliament will have 423 members. That's 27 fewer than the normal at this point. So with 98% of the vote counted at this point, closer to 99, President Poroshenko's bloc will have 132 seats in parliament. Prime Minister Yatsenyuk's People's Front will have 83. Lviv Mayor Sadovay's Self-Reliance Party will have 33 seats. And Timoshenko's Fatherland Bloc will have 17. So if you just look at those parties, you can, I guess you could call them really the clear, distinct pro-European parties that made it through in the party list. They essentially don't really have any ideological difference, I would say. So if you tally those numbers together, you get about 267 votes. If that ends up being the coalition, it'd be a strong majority for pushing through reforms and European integration and forming a government. Now, if you add Yashko's Radical Party, which Prime Minister Yatsenyuk proposed today, actually, that number would grow to 289. So one would think with the Poroshenko bloc's very strong result that they would perhaps be picking a prime minister from their ranks. But I think you also need to look at, and people are looking, of course, at their results in terms of the how people did in their part on the party list. So in terms of the party lists, Yatsenyuk's People's Front came through with just over 22%, and Poroshenko's bloc just under 22%, with Self-Reliance at 11, Timoshenko at about 5.5, Leshko at 7.5, and the opposition bloc with just over 9. So I guess in a sense, I think Yatsenyuk's party, and they feel that they kind of had the momentum with the election now. And today, Yatsenyuk announced that as the party that received the largest percentage of votes in the party list, that it would be natural for him and for his bloc to lead the efforts of forming a coalition with him as prime minister. Yatsenyuk also said that he sees President Poroshenko and the Poroshenko bloc as strategic partners, and that the goal of the coalition should be implementing all the aspects of the EU association agreement, with the ultimate goal being EU membership. And it certainly would be a very positive sign for Ukraine if the coalition could be formed rather quickly. Another reason, perhaps, that it'd be natural for Yatsenyuk to stay on as prime minister is the fact that I think generally in Ukraine and in the West, he's recognized as having done a pretty credible job and competent job in this crisis period. And you might also want to think, you might think that it might be, being prime minister might be a bit of a thankless job at this point with all the difficult issues facing Ukraine, and the implementation of reforms will actually be very painful for a lot of people. At this point, you can't say for 100% for sure that Yatsenyuk will be the next prime minister. At least at this point, as of today, Poroshenko's bloc, President Poroshenko has not stated that they support Yatsenyuk as the next prime minister. That just might be part of the negotiations, the back and forth that's going on now about all the different positions that will be filled in the government. And actually, as part of their coalition proposal, kind of the plan for the coalition, the Poroshenko bloc is talking about forming some kind of a coalition council, which I guess would be a way for the president to exert more influence over the coalition. Another thing that's worth mentioning is that quite often people have talked about the need or how it'd be very helpful for the pro-European people in parliament to have what's a constitutional majority, a two-thirds majority, to make changes to the constitution in favor of reform. An example of one idea that was proposed would be one of the first things they could pass, for example, would be stripping members of parliament of their immunity, which many people feel leads to problems of corruption, send a big signal to Ukrainian society. So as I mentioned before, with just strictly from the members of the parties that were elected, we're seeing somewhere between 260, 70, 80, up to maybe 290 pro-European members of parliament. But there are another 100 members of parliament that were got elected that were not affiliated with a party or were members of smaller parties. Certainly many of those will be former members of the Party of Regions, but of course a very large number will also be Western-oriented, European-oriented, if you will. Just a couple quick examples. The Viktor Bolaha, Yushchenko's former chief of staff in Transcarpathia, and a couple of his relatives got seats, were elected. Also, you have two members of Svoboda in Kyiv districts that were elected. So I think it seems pretty reasonable to assume that there will be a two-thirds constitutional majority for European reforms, if you will. I think one of the perhaps more difficult things to accept or a bit disheartening for people, especially after watching all the tragedy of the Maidan and the victory of Maidan and over dictatorship, if you will, is really the rather strong showing of many of the dark figures of the Yanukovych era, who people like Energy Minister Boyko or Yanukovych's chief of staff, Yavochkin, who never really had to explain to society their role in the crackdown and the Maidan. But anyway, I think that group anyway deserves an award for perhaps the most innovative or audacious rebranding of their party, calling themselves the opposition bloc now. Anyway, the opposition bloc garnered a bit over 9% of the vote, and they'll have 29 seats in the parliament. And they'll obviously be strengthened by many people that ran as unaffiliated but hail from regions originally. An example of that you can see in, for example, in Kharkiv Oblast, where the opposition bloc got 32% of the vote. And of the 15 districts, only one district went to a pro-European party, the People's Front. The other 12, Ukrainska Pravda reported, are actually former members of the Party of Regions who actually voted for the dictatorial laws of January 16th, which helped fuel the Maidan protests. And overall, it's been reported that some 62 members of parliament were actually members from the old parliament that had voted for these the so-called dictatorial laws. So certainly the Party of Regions did not disappear totally. However, Yuri Lutsenko, the former interior minister and now leading figure in Poroshenko's bloc, said that perhaps the presence of these members, former members of the Party of Regions, the opposition bloc, it'll help be a good reminder for everybody in parliament of what they don't want to return to. Another thing I'd like to mention is how these elections demonstrated the change in the electorate, the sympathies of the electorate in terms of their views about Europe. I think the divisions, perhaps from previous elections, such a distinct East-West division, those have tended to dissipate. For example, in the Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, you see, if you count up the Poroshenko, Yatsenyuk, and self-reliance votes, together they got about 40% of the vote, whereas the opposition and Communist parties got a total of 30. So you do see that shift happening. And also, Poroshenko's bloc won outright, won a plurality in Mykolaiv, Kherson, Odessa. So you do see the pro-European parties truly strengthened throughout the country. And just before I wrap up, one more quick comment about kind of the character of the tone of the campaign. I think for many parties, they kind of came up with a formula, I suppose you could call it a winning formula, where their party consisted of officials, experienced members of government, heroes of the Maidan or military heroes from the battles going on in eastern Ukraine, young reformers, NGO activists, even respected journalists. So just some quick examples from Yatsenyuk's People's Front, of course, Prime Minister Yatsenyuk. You have the speaker and former acting president, Turchinov, Maidan activist Tanya Chernoval, Maidan commander Andriy Poruby, the Self-Reliance Party, which was kind of came out of nowhere to get, as I said, about 11% of the vote. It was a party established by the mayor of Lviv, but had as the candidate in the number one spot on their ticket was a reform leader, Hanna Hopko, who her team has been responsible for drafting many new, new reform legislation. You had Donbass battalion leader, Semenchenko. You have an IT business leader in the number three spot. And of course, in the Poroshenko bloc, many important names from government, obviously named after the president himself, the bloc was. And then, you know, Klitschko, Lutsenko, Groysman, Crimean Tatar leader, Jemilev, and education minister Kvit, Maidan doctor, Olha Bohomolets. And then NGO leaders like Svetlana Zalishchuk and famous investigative reporters like Sidhi Leshchenko and Mustafa Nayem. Perhaps in our discussion portion, we can return to another issue that would be worth discussing, and that's some of the shortcomings and issues of turnout.
Thanks very much, Adrian. I mean, obviously, this has really created a very different picture of Ukrainian politics, and, you know, hopefully as we get into the Q&A, we can discuss that a little bit more. That very last point that you left us with about the turnout, that does lead to some questions, I guess, as we hand over to Anders and then to Lilia, about what the implications of that might be. In this case, from your perspective, Anders, about whether that is really a mandate for reform. Because this is obviously something you have been grappling with in your own work for some time, about the impetus and the mobilization, not just at the political level, but also at the societal level, for really pushing through what might be painful reforms. And, you know, does this parliamentary election really give us what Ukraine needs at this particular point?
Yeah, thank you very much, Fiona, for a very nice introduction. And I was in Ukraine last month, and the main impression is of a nation coming together. You see it in so many ways. Most people in the streets in Kiev speak Russian. This is not a matter of language. But lots of the people now wear Vyshivanka, the traditional Ukrainian folk shirt. And all over Ukraine, young activists are painting all these lousy railings, blue and yellow, and are collecting money for it. They are doing it voluntarily. And my guess is that no country in the world really has as strong a civil activist movement as Ukraine today. So what we saw now in the election, as Adrian discussed, is the three most pro-European and reformist parties got a comfortable majority. And either these three or with one or two more parties will form a coalition. This is Ukraine's big chance to make a break with everything that has been wrong. So what has been wrong in Ukraine? That there was never a clear disruption from the communist rule. The Ukrainian government today is as centralized as it was in Soviet time. It's free, yes, but it doesn't function. Everything is too centralized. And this is also within the government, that in order to get any decision done, you need 20 to 30 signatures, which means that nobody is responsible and nobody is accountable. And Ukraine needs to get a break of this. But looking today upon the economic situation, you can say that it is frightful, but not hopeless. Something has to be done. Why? Probably GDP in Ukraine will fall by 8 to 10% this year. Two-thirds or three-quarters of its decline comes from the war in the East. The rest comes from Yanukovych's complete mismanagement. So this is a domestic crisis. It's not caused by the outside world, apart from Russia's war of aggression, of course. So what does Russia do? It bombs the power stations in the east. As a consequence, the pumps stop in the coal mines, and the coal mines are flooded for a long time. Therefore, in the last 2 months, coal production in Ukraine has fallen by more than half, steel production by one-third. This is where you see the fall in GDP coming from. And about 10% of GDP is in the occupied part Donbass. As a result of this massive fall in output, the GDP, the budget deficit this year will probably be 12 to 15%. The IMF said only 10% in July on much more optimistic numbers. I don't believe it. If this continues, Ukraine will be in default in a year or so. So therefore, this must not continue. It must stop. So what do you need to do then? First of all, you need to have a political change. And now Ukraine has had successful and democratic presidential and parliamentary elections. The next step is, as Adrian discussed, to get a new government. I think that should be relatively easy without getting into the details. Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk are, with little doubt, the two most competent leading politicians Ukraine has had. By the way, they are the only two who actually speak English and are perfectly fluent, not to say eloquent, in that language. And I think it's excellent then to have the civil activist self-reliance party checking them. You need to have somebody who checks that things are open, transparent, and honest in a country where the main problem is pervasive corruption. So that's the first thing, the political change, and that we're essentially seeing already. The second thing is to reform the state. Here you have an idea in the West that you can only have individual justice and not collective justice. Therefore, Westerners tend not to like lustration. The countries that have carried out lustration, that is massive sacking of the old cadres in Eastern Europe, are the three Baltic countries, the Czech Republic and Poland. These are the most democratic countries. If you have a rotten, corrupt, essentially old Soviet bureaucracy, you need to sack them. Sack them all. And start from the top. Sack 200,000 people. If you have been a judge in Ukraine, there are 10,000 of them, you are by definition corrupt. Otherwise, you would not be appointed a judge. Then clean them out and start anew. This is what this government seems intent on doing. The law on lustration was adopted in September, and lustration is already starting. Then, of course, you need to change organization to a normal Western organization. The EU is excellent in this with its twinning of European state agencies with Ukrainian state agencies. 60 of these projects are underway. And you need to deregulate. The state should not do what it did in Soviet times. Ukraine has 83 inspection agencies. I think that 11 of them can be justified. I mean, you need to have a nuclear inspection, for example, but you don't need to have a trade inspection. And the Anti-Monopoly Committee in Ukraine is not fighting monopoly. It's fighting for monopoly. Whenever you go into a Ukrainian restaurant, you find each page of a menu has three signatures by the senior managers of that restaurant and a stamp on each page. Otherwise, the Anti-Monopoly Committee will complain. This is the degree of bureaucracy. So there's so much to clean up. And then you say, but won't people protest? No, they will be happy. This is a place where things really need to be cleaned out. But then we have a financial crisis. Ukraine needs to clean out substantially with public expenditures. Well, the US normally has about one third of GDP or slightly more in public expenditure. Ukraine has 53% of GDP in public expenditures. And this does not go to the people, this goes to the corrupt oligarchs. So take out one-tenth of GDP in public expenditure straight away. Do away with the energy subsidies. This is the best thing that can happen to Ukraine. If you don't do it instantly, when you have a new political mandate, it won't be done because somebody will come in and buy gas at a low state-controlled price, as has always been done before, and sell it at a 10 times higher market price. So this must be done fast. Otherwise, these people who will come in and control that business, they tend to vary. They will buy the new government. This is necessary for in order to fight corruption. So these are the main things that really need to be done. And, of course, you want to make the state more efficient. You have to decentralize. This is about what the constitutional changes are about. And you want to do the social sector more efficient. Therefore, you also have to decentralize. Ukraine wastes money, and it should stop doing so. Therefore, massive reform are needed, and these reforms are approved by a lot of the population because they know that the society is pervasively corrupt and they don't like it. Corruption is never popular anywhere. People are always against it. That is the majority, not necessarily the people at the top who benefit from the corruption. And then I come to the final point, and that is Western assistance. Ukraine has to do a lot on its own, but it needs assistance to do this. Ukraine needs substantial financing to go through this. Therefore, a week ago, I published an article in the Financial Times arguing for a Marshall Plan for Ukraine, because this is a matter of, it's quite similar to the Marshall Plan situation. It's a matter of war damage. It's a matter of humanitarian assistance to people who are suffering. It's a matter of rebuilding infrastructure. The Russian troops have intentionally bombed the bridges in the east. They've also taken away a couple of military industrial enterprises in the east and taken them home to Russia, suggesting that they don't want to occupy or annex the territory but leave it as damaged as possible. And Ukraine is now doing everything that the West could ask for, and therefore the West needs to support Ukraine. It's also a question of the West needing to come together for its own sake. So I think that this is a big moment of test, not only for the new Ukrainian government, but also for the West, for the United States, and particularly for the European Union. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Anders, and I commend, obviously, your FT article to everyone to read. And you've obviously laid out a very bold set of reforms for Ukraine. I can already see tens of thousands of Ukrainian judges starting to picket outside of the, if they can get here, of course, outside of the Peterson Institute. But obviously,
they wouldn't be.
Yes, well, exactly. But that also does, of course, lay open the questions about how Moscow will react to that. Because when, you know, as you're laying out, we look back to the period of lustration in the countries that you mentioned, I mean, the Baltic states after the collapse of the Soviet Union, but the Czech Republic and Poland, that obviously happened in a very different geopolitical time frame when every country around was in a state of collapse and trying to figure out how they were going to move forward. And as you've pointed out, Ukraine has lost a lot of time in tackling some of the issues. This is already 20-odd years have passed in which some of these things needed to be done. And obviously, the kind of the idea of sacking hundreds of thousands of people from a bureaucracy obviously will make Ukraine somewhat politically vulnerable at that time. I mean, you know that, obviously, as you have laid this out. But I'm wondering, you know, then, in that background, all the things that have to be done in Ukraine, about this, how this will have an impact on Russia's attitudes towards Ukraine, and also how, frankly, the view from Moscow is on these elections. As we've pointed out, the elections were not possible in parts of the Donbass that are still in a state of war. And the 53% turnout is obviously actually pretty good in a Western sense. I mean, there are a lot of elections that happen in European countries where there's much lower turnout than that, obviously in the 39 to 40-odd percentage, in which, you know, pass the muster in a normal situation. But this isn't really a normal situation. So how is this likely to be viewed from Moscow, Lilia?
Well, Fiona, thank you, first of all, for having me. And I have to admit that I have a complicated problem. And the problem is, simply, I don't know how to give due to obsession in a mere 5-6 minutes. Because Ukraine, as a state, as a nation, as the Ukrainian factor, as the phenomena of the post-Soviet space, have become the obsession in the Kremlin, in Putin's mind, for the Russian political elite. It became a drug for the Russian population. And in fact, when you watch Russian TV, when you read Russian newspapers, when you talk to Russians, you'll see that there is no Russian politics anymore. There is no Russian agenda anymore because Ukraine has replaced everything. There is Ukraine from early morning till night and at night as well. And in fact, by doing this, Putin and the Kremlin have digged a grave for themselves. It's more than a trap. Because Putin cannot be defeated in Ukraine. Defeat will mean that he goes down in flames. But he cannot win either. And so how to get out of this trap, conundrum, you name it, nobody knows. The West doesn't know. Russia doesn't know. And Ukrainians are still drifting, even after elections, in the zone that many people are calling Finlandization. So I have only two brief points, if I may. And in fact, my colleagues have made it easier for me. Following on what Anders has just said, I would agree. Ukrainians demonstrate the amazing, desperate, and phenomenal drive, thirst, longing for political and social activism. But I would add, if you would agree, one more characteristic of the Ukrainian nation, as I see it from outside, from, you know, the armpit of the big brother. Ukrainians, starting with 2004 and especially last year today, behave much more European than Europeans. They demonstrate much more dignity, longing for democratic and European values than at least leadership of all European countries that call to accommodate, to respect something, well, not to corner someone, to save someone's face, etc., etc. And here are my two brief points, well, that I will do in a way of brush strokes. Firstly, responding to Fiona's question, what is the Kremlin, not my agenda, but the Kremlin agenda regarding Ukraine? Ukraine has become, for Putin's Russia, for the Russian political system of personalized power, a factor of crucial domestic importance. This is the instrument, the means to pursue, first of all, domestic agenda. And here, Ukraine is the testing field, the laboratory, the platform, the ground, okay, to implement Putin's doctrine of survival that was adopted before Ukraine, before the last Ukraine rally started. It was adopted and worked out during 2012 to 2013. There were reasons why he did it, but he has changed his regime, and his new doctrine is based on the principle Russia is a unique state civilization, and we contain the West. So in Ukraine, Russia is containing the West, is battling not with Poroshenko or with Maidan, is battling with the West. This is how Putin understands it. Secondly, Ukraine became a powerful mobilization factor for the Russian political elite, that is now consolidating society. For the first time during the last 20 years, returning to the traditional matrix on the basis of the besieged fortress, constant search for an enemy, domestic and extensive. And so Ukraine gave the platform for military patriotic mobilization. But you know, if you dragged, shifted country into the state of war, and if you became the war president, you know, it's very difficult to find something up your sleeve to consolidate nation further. You have to invent other triggers and arguments for war. Thirdly, Putin and the elite now understand what maybe they misunderstood earlier. Without Ukraine being, you know, in Russia's pocket, Russia cannot legitimize itself historically as the state with its 1,000-year history. Because in this case, with Ukraine jumping the board, Russia will have start its history in 12th century at least. Okay, this will be a different history of Moscovia, but not, you know, connecting Russia to Kiev and Rus. And one more, of course, in Ukraine, Putin and the Russian elite are erasing the philosophy, the doctrine of Maidan, in order to prevent any kind of the repetition in Russia. And you'll ask me, and where is the international factor that, well, so many people are talking about? The international origins of the war, of the crisis, of the Russian invasion. Whereas, you know, this, you know, what about these arguments about Russia's humiliation or NATO enlargement? The last enlargement, as we remember, Fiona will Steve Pfeiffer will correct me, happened in 2008. So why the Kremlin waited for such a long time finally to get humiliated? And why Russia, Russian political elite, does not find it humiliating to be, you know, personally incorporated into Leningrad? But I would say there is international factor, but the factor of a different nature, weakness of the West, dysfunctionality of the EU, retrenchment of the United States, leading from behind. I forgot who was the president who was leading from behind. And, you know, the view that dominates in the Kremlin, that the West is so pathetic that we have to fill the niche just now, because the West is in permanent decay. It's typical Oswald Spengler's philosophy. And second point, so what about post-election Ukraine that my friends have been discussing? I would say that President Putin and the system are demonstrating amazing ability to adapt. So invasion, incursion, of course, will stay on the agenda, will be on the table for a long time, because definitely, you know, the corridor to Crimea, Mariupol, well, it's still on the table. Transnistria, cut from Russia by a hostile Ukraine, of course, needs a corridor, but we have to think about the umbrella of instruments and means, such as cooptation of the Ukrainian elite, bribing and cooptation and making trade-offs with Ukrainian oligarchs, and especially, I'm not mentioning names, but with the exception of one, they all still have their interests in Russia, and also working with a new composition of doom, and there is not only Medvedchuk outside of that, but there are apparently people who would like to get $30,000 monthly. And not only intentionally bribing and co-opting, simply there is a position of wait and see while Ukraine is going to freeze. And there is information war, propaganda warfare, there is gas warfare, and there is absolutely skillful and amazing international Russian campaign that has started now. Counter-offensive, playing with the European international right-wing forces, left-wing forces, all those who hate United States and the EU, and there are a lot of them, 30% of the European deputies are just like that, ready to be co-opted. Moreover, just look at the Trojan horses within the European Union. Hungary and Italy, just yesterday, demanded to abrogate the sanctions. And when you look at not only Hungary, but Slovakia, Czech Republic, well, Serbia is not part, but also a Trojan horse. So there is a possibility, you know, to undermine the sanction regime, to undermine the European unity regarding Ukraine. And finally, I would believe, I still don't know how to argue it, because there are so many questions that we don't have the answer to, but I would argue that 2004 in European and world's history could have much more serious implications because of the war with Ukraine, because of the Russian incursion, because Russia has ruined not only post-Cold War settlement, but also Yalta and Westphalian system. So repercussions of this phenomena could be much more serious than the results of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991.
Well, thank you, Lilia, for again another very assertive.
I was happy to be optimistic, yes.
Yes, you were a little bit too much. So, Steve, you're now left with the unenviable, I think, task of how do we deal with all of this, given the fact that as we've progressively moved along from what seems like a more optimistic assessment of how the elections have turned out, we've gone through the whole range of challenges that need to be met, but we've also, as Lily has left us, been presented with a much larger geopolitical challenge, which we'll also be tackling in the second column. But, you know, how do you think that the United States and the Europeans should start to think about this?
Well, let me try to present a degree of optimism, but also with a note of realism. But first, let me just say, I think in terms of the West view, the election that took place on Sunday was positive in two ways. First, and very importantly, it was a free, democratic, competitive election. Got high marks from OSCE, from other observers. I mean, it checked that box, and that's important. And then second, the result of the election, as Adrian described, is you're going to have a majority of seats in the new Rada occupied by parties that are on paper in favor of reform and in favor of drawing closer to the European Union. And I do believe that that reflects the current Ukrainian national mood. I also was in Ukraine in September, and it really is striking, something that I did not see when I was there for 3 years at the end of the 1990s, this strong sense of Ukrainian national identity, largely delivered by Vladimir Putin. Now, it's also, I think, a very important moment for Ukraine. And I think a starting point here would be to say, Ukraine throughout this crisis has been in a weak, fragile, vulnerable position, first and foremost, not because of the Russians, but because of bad decisions by 20 years of Ukraine's leaders. They haven't done the necessary reforms. They haven't done the changes. And there's maybe not an expectation, but certainly a hope in the West that they're going to act now. They're going to break out of that cycle. And the first thing here is, you know, can Petro Poroshenko, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, working with other leaders, can they put together a coalition that's going to be stable, that can work together, that makes the necessary compromises so it's as broad as possible, and that can then push forward on a very tough agenda? And I think the worry here is that if you get division, that creates an opportunity. And I think, as you alluded to, I mean, the Russians will look for opportunities if there's a fractious Rada to try to exploit that and make some mischief. And I also worry that in that case, you may get a degree of Western disillusionment. So the first thing is very quickly putting together a stable majority in the Rada, which then appoints a prime minister and a cabinet, and hopefully then you have a Rada majority, a cabinet, and a president. We're all working on the same sheet of music in terms of tackling reforms. And there's just a lot of need. Andres mentioned some of them. Economic reform, political decentralization, pushing some political authority out to the regions makes a lot of sense above and beyond the specific deals regarding Donetsk and Luhansk. Anti-corruption measures, reform of the energy sector, doing something about the judicial reform, and Andres has presented one fairly radical solution, but fire the judges. But a lot of these reforms have been delayed over the last 8 months. And certainly, I think one of the things I heard, I think Andres probably heard in September, was a certain frustration that there hasn't been movement on economic change, there hasn't been movement on anti-corruption. And to some extent, I think that's understandable, because you had the huge focus on the crisis in eastern Ukraine. And President Poroshenko said, look, I need to get a new parliament in place. So he now has that. And so the question will be is, can they act? If there's further delay, that's not only going to be bad for Ukraine, but I worry it's going to make it more difficult for Ukraine's relations with the West. Now, looking at the United States and Europe, it seems to me there are two or three basic interests they have in Ukraine. You know, first of all, particularly from the point of Europe, but I think this is also an American interest, you know, you want to see a successful, stable, prosperous state that borders institutional Europe on the borders of NATO and the European Union. The flip side is you don't want to see Ukraine become a failed state. Second, there's a above and beyond the Ukraine angle, I think there is an important need for the West to push back against Russia, which I believe has broken the fundamental rule of post-Cold War security in Europe, which is big states don't use military force to take territory from other states. And that's such an egregious violation, there needs to be a Western response. And then I would add for the United States, there's one other factor here, which is in 1994, the United States, along with Russia and Britain, signed the Budapest Memorandum of Security Assurances, which agreed to recognize Ukraine's sovereignty, its territorial integrity, its independence, not to use force against Ukraine. These have all been violated by the Russians. But it imposes, I think, a certain obligation on the United States to respond, because this is a very big piece of the answer that got Ukraine to agree to give up what was at the time the world's third largest nuclear arsenal. So looking at where the West is now, it seems to me there's three vectors to the Western response to this crisis. First of all has been to support Ukraine. I think a lot's been done on the political side. Vice President Biden's going to Kyiv next month. That'll be his third visit this year. And that kind of political interaction, I think, is good in terms of bolstering Ukraine diplomatically. Economic support, there's a very good IMF program and other support on the table. As Anders said, more is going to be needed. I think the one thing I would argue for that hasn't been done is I think there should be greater consideration to military assistance to Ukraine, including provision of defensive arms to the Ukrainian military as a way of deterring a further outbreak of fighting. The second area of the Western response has really not been related to Ukraine directly, but it's been more bolstering NATO. And that is, you now see things that didn't happen 8 months ago. You see some NATO military forces in the Baltic states, in Poland, not on a permanent basis, but on a persistent basis. I think persistent is perhaps the new permanent. But that's designed to reassure those states who are now much more nervous about Russia. But it's also to make clear that there's a very strong red line. That, well, I think it was clear, and it's understood in both Kyiv and Moscow, NATO's not going to go to war over Ukraine. NATO would go to war to defend an ally. Now, it's important for, I think, NATO reassurance. There is a bit of a sour note in that, what I heard when I was in Kyiv, is, well, they thought that the speech that President Obama gave in Estonia was very good for reassuring Estonia, but they also said, but also made clear that we're on the wrong side of that red line he drew. The third part here, a Western policy, has been to punish Russia with the goal of trying to affect the change in Russian policy. And the primary instrument here has been economic sanctions. And if you look at the effect of the sanctions, they are having, I think, a significant impact on the Russian economy in terms of, it seems, every week now the ruble hits a new low versus the dollar or the euro, lots of capital flight. Every time I've seen an economic projection for the Russian economy, it seems to be getting worse. The Bank of America came out last week and projected that in 2015, in fact, the Russian economy would contract by 1.5%. So there are economic costs, but they haven't yet succeeded in achieving the main political goal, which is to get Russia to change its policy on eastern Ukraine and become a part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And unfortunately, when you look at Russian actions thus far, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that the Russian goal is not to promote a settlement on the basis of the September ceasefire agreement, but to promote another frozen conflict in eastern Ukraine as a means to have leverage over the government in Kyiv. Now, looking forward, it seems to me that there's a lot of issues that have to be dealt with on eastern Ukraine, but it's really important that the Ukrainian government and the RADA get down to work on real change, real reform, and that's going to be important to sustain Western support. I think Anders is right. Ukraine is going to need more financial assistance. It's likely going to have to ask for it. I think it's going to be hard for the United States or Europe to find much more, but I'm absolutely certain that unless there's seen to be real delivery on real reform, you know, the question's not going to get a hearing in the West. So a precondition for getting more assistance is going to be the Ukrainian government and the parliament moving out and doing these reforms, which have been delayed for a long, long time. I also say that the failure to move very quickly in the next few months on reform is going to have not only some internal negative repercussions, I think, in terms of disillusionment within Ukraine, but there also is a risk that the West may conclude that Ukraine is not fixable. And I think that impacts the first and the third vectors I talked about, support for Ukraine and penalizing Russia. those vectors may be coming unraveling if the West begins to conclude that, Ukraine just can't get its act together to address these problems. We can't help Ukraine if Ukraine's not taking the steps to help itself. And then I think the United States, you've got a very busy foreign policy agenda. If Ukraine begins to or doesn't take some of the necessary steps, you get the questioning here, is Ukraine really worthy of the sort of attention it needs? Do you see a return of Ukraine fatigue here? And I think the question within the European Union is it's pretty clear that there are several European states that really would like to get past sanctions, would get back to business as usual. And it's going to be harder for those European states who believe in the sanctions to sustain that position if Ukraine's not seen to be moving in the right direction. So I guess my immediate recommendation for the West now, it's really time for a tough love message to Kyiv, which is you've got to do things. The West is ready to support Ukraine, but Ukraine has to be acting first and foremost. And I think Anders, you're right. This is a test for the West, but we're not going to get to that test for the West unless the Ukraine does the necessary. So really the ball is in Kyiv's court, and I think there's not maybe an expectation because expectations have been disappointed, but certainly a hope in the West that Ukraine now seizes this opportunity and begins to make the actions and the steps that are necessary to get it on a very different course from what we've seen over the last 20 years.
Thank you very much, Steve. We have half an hour, and I know there are many people in the audience here with their own expertise and views on this, so I'd like to try to bring you in right away. We have some microphones somewhere around, which will be coming down. I'll try to group questions together, so I'll take three questions, actually, and I would ask each of you to introduce yourself, say who you are, and then try to keep the questions as brief as possible so that I can then go back to the panel and then back out to the audience again. There's a gentleman right at the back, and then the lady here, and a gentleman over here, and then I'll move to this side, please.
Hi, my name is David Nikuradze. I represent Georgian television station Rustavito in Washington, D.C. Russia is going to receive first Mistral in France in the next couple of days. I was wondering if you could give me your reaction on that, please. Thank you.
A question about the Mistral and a question here from this lady here in the aisle. The microphone's coming here on this way.
Thanks for all the presentations about the democracy and about the election, whether it's free or fair. I'm very much in skepticism, especially compared to the United States. I just wonder which party among those is the most or least corruptive, and they are willing to stand up for the social justice. And who is the one monitoring all the fairness of elections? I think in America, nobody's really come up to stand up for that. A lot of mischief, a lot of misconduct, a lot of fraud and crime occur, and in the United States, from local to federal, nobody stand up to clean that up. So I just wonder, if U.S. want to support a Ukrainian, is it based on the corruption to support or the other way around?
Thank you. And then the gentleman in the next row just over here, the third row back. Thank you.
Thanks. Mike Hoffman, the Wilson Center. Two quick questions. One for Lilia Shevtsova. You mentioned that Ukraine is essentially a trap for the Kremlin. To what extent do you think their objectives are achievable, and to what extent do you think they can change the goalpost, meaning change what winning in Ukraine means? And looking at it now, kind of listen to your presentation, the impression I got that the best move for Moscow now is to try to make Ukraine a failure, not because of a Russian military campaign, but on its own terms, essentially to undermine it in a political and economic way. And as we all know, destroying a country is a lot easier than building one. So perhaps the Russian goal is to make Ukraine a policy success, more like Iraq, Libya, and some of the other policy successes we've had in nation building over the last decade. So I'd like to hear your opinion as to where we're moving forward with that and to what extent the Kremlin can alter the terms of its own victory for the Russian public. And a quick question for Steve is, Steve, if we genuinely need, a response to Russia's challenge to the international order, right now it looks like the sanctions that nobody wants to keep going are it. So what are the ultimate consequences of this? And at least I see now a rumor that the French might go forward with the sale of the Mistral after all this November, which to me is kind of the beginning of the sanctions going down the river. Thanks.
Thanks. So there's two questions related to the Mistral there. But perhaps, Adrian and then Anders, you could comment on this whole kind of question about the democratic content of the elections and, you know, the basically the various positions of the parties and then how we deal with it. And then we'll move on to Lily and Steve with the specific questions to them.
Sure. So I would say that the Western Observer missions that were in Ukraine, the election observer missions, I think everybody gave a pretty solid and good assessment of the elections as being free and fair. I think, you know, an interesting aspect of the election, we talked about the turnout, and certainly it was affected by the conflict and the aggression of Russia, then, you know, something perhaps that Putin didn't think about many months ago, and occupation of Crimea, that just to quote Olha Izoska of the NGO Opora, they did an estimate of how many people would not be able to vote in this election. And just prior to the election, it was 1.8 million in Crimea, 1.6 million in Donetsk Oblast, and 1.2 million in Luhansk Oblast, that be in occupied territories and or territories not under the control of the government. So you're looking at about 4.5 million people that were not able to participate in this election that probably were a pretty solid electorate for the Party of Regions in the past. So that certainly had a very, very big impact on the makeup of the parliament and the choices that people had. So that was one consequence. In terms of least corrupt party, perhaps the Self-Reliance Party might say that it's them, because none of them, I believe, have held national office yet. So.
Anders, how does that look from your perspective? And you know the political players very well also in Ukraine.
There was a group of economists who made an analysis of the party programs. And the People's Front, Prime Minister Yatsenyuk's party, and Self-Reliance, the New Civil Activist Party, have the most reformist platforms, in words, what they are pushing for. Of course, Self-Reliance, since these are new civil activists, they are, so to say, the proof of the pudding that they will at least initially stand for honesty and fight corruption. But all the parties in parliament, apart from, four of the parties in parliament, have civil activists who are new politicians. So you needed to have that in order to do reasonably well in the election. The Poroshenko bloc and Faberland, Yulia Tymoshenko's party, are reformist but less concrete. Then you have the opposition bloc, which is the remnants of President Yanukovych's regions. No one would accuse that party of being honest in any relevant regard. And then you have the completely populist party, the radical party of Oleg Lyashko, which presents ideas like increase healthcare expenditures as a share of GDP 10 times in the next 6 years. This is one of the most positive proposals. At the same time, they want to cut the taxes. So their program doesn't hang together in any relevant regard. Can I ask on the sanctions also, although the question was directed to Steve? The fundamental thing about sanctions is my colleagues, Gary Huffbar and Jeff Short, have written a big book about the experience of economic sanctions after the Second World War. And a few of their major conclusions is 30% of the sanctions work. So economic sanctions are by and large not effective, but sometimes they are. The more limited the purpose of economic sanctions are, the more likely they are to be successful. The more countries that are involved in carrying out the sanctions, the more likely they are to be successful, which is a reason why the United States is so anxious in this case to act together with the European Union. But if you have implemented economic sanctions, they stick. Just look up on the sanctions against Cuba. Few people would favor them a priori, but since they are in place, they won't be taken away until they succeed. And since they don't succeed, they continue. I'm quite sure that this is true of European sanctions, because in order to change them, you need to have a consensus. Because they have been imposed with consensus. It's said that they should be temporary for only 1 year, but nothing is as permanent as temporary measures. So they will stick.
I might one more quick comment on the democracy issue. I think one issue that would probably be worthwhile for the parliament to take up is kind of some reforms in terms of the election process. You have in many, many districts, you have so many candidates running that many people got through to parliament with well under 30% of the vote in their district being elected to represent their district. You had 29 parties. You had big national debates with 29 parties. I think it's very difficult for voters to understand what the differences are in these parties. So, you know, some kind of a system of primaries or reducing the numbers of people competing would probably be helpful to the electorate.
So another part of the next phase of reform. So Lilia and Steve, there were several questions directed at you. And Lilia, you know, I think the question was quite clear about the next for Russia. And Steve, if you have anything to say on the Mistral as well, that would be great.
Well, your question, the next steps and maneuvers on the part of the Russian Kremlin. Kremlin. Well, it's a kind of test for my ability to twist my brains, okay? I do believe we have to pay attention, first of all, to how the Kremlin will solve its own position on how they would like to view Donetsk and Luhansk Republic. So far as I see, there is struggle going on in their brains and between themselves, because until recently, Moscow tried, at least hoped and wanted, to have Lugansk and Donetsk occupied territories as part of Ukraine. So Ukraine and the EU will pay money for that, stabilize, etc. But at the same time, these so-called special status entities will have their independence to deal with the outside world. Okay, in fact, you know, it will be a knife in the Ukrainian's body. So far, it's very difficult to rein in the separatist forces, and it's very difficult, apparently, to find consensus within the Kremlin as to how to proceed. So the election and the endorsement of this election results by the Kremlin, November elections, will be a step that will finally demonstrate what position the Kremlin took. For me, very important is the issue of borders between Russia and Ukraine. And the role of OSCE, because as you remember, the peace plan, September peace plan, envisages some kind of control and how to control more than 100 kilometers. When the OSCE monitors, directed by Russia, and so many Russians, you know, direct departments within the OSCE, they direct only two checkpoints, okay? It's how many? 2 kilometers, 5 kilometers, etc. So open borders. And we know how OSCE monitors are working. We know how they worked in Georgia and Ossetia. We know how they're working at the border of Azerbaijan and Armenia. They come after the accident or unhappiness. They do a file, they do a report and file it, and then they vanish, okay? So OSCE, this is the problem in such situations. In any case, I would say that, you know, the 16th century system like we have in Russia has ability to use 21st century political kits, political tools, and they will be using victory. You know, my hunch is that it would be very difficult for the Kremlin to imitate victory in the Kremlin per se. They will try to imitate victory in Crimea because this is Crimea, not Crimea. Crimea became the most powerful consolidating factor. But in winter, Crimea, I guess, will vanish from the Russian TV screens because Crimea is going to be a disaster for many reasons. And hardly Russia will find $20 billion to save the situation in Crimea. And even the $6 billion breach over the Kerch Strait is also a kind of very big question mark. So it seems to me the Russian leadership will be trying to look for victory in another area, and this scares me. And just, and by the way, Russians are not that stupid and not drugged totally, because now only 23% of Russian respondents would like to have a military solution in Ukraine. And 84% of Russians, for the first time in the post-communist war history, sees that Russia is surrounded by enemies by the West. And at the same time, 68 of them would like to normalize a relationship with the West. So it's a kind of already cognitive dissonance in our brains, which is a positive thing. Would you take Mistral?
Mistral, I mean, there were a spate of reports out of France yesterday and the day before suggesting that the transfer of the Mistral to the Russian Navy would go forward in mid-November. Today, I think actually the French president's office came out and denied that. So we'll see. I think it would be an absolutely horrible message to Moscow if Russia, if France goes forward with the transfer of the helicopter assault ship. In September, when the French suspended the sale, they basically said it would depend on Russian actions. If you look at that point up to now, it's very, very difficult to make a case that Russia has done anything constructive. And Lilia touched on the issue of securing the Russian-Ukraine border with OSC monitors. Last week in Vienna, the Russian delegate vetoed an OSC move to expand the OSC presence on that border. Yesterday, Foreign Minister Lavrov said that Russia would recognize the separatists conducted elections this Sunday in Donetsk and Luhansk. Again, the agreements say that there will be local elections, but conducted in a manner consistent with Ukrainian law. So I think it's fairly clear Russia is actually not only not fulfilling the requirements that fall on Russia, it's also clear they're not using their influence with the separatists. And at least in this case of recognizing these local election results, Russia is actually, I think, moving in a way that directly contradicts the agreements that were reached. I just had the point on sanctions. I think they may not be the best tool, but at this point, they're about the only tool the West has. I mean, it's pretty clear the West is not going to use direct military force. There's been a surge, and I think sanctions have come out as the tool that works. And I think Anders' point is right. The sanctions that were imposed basically, they have to be reviewed after a year. But I think that does sort of change the dynamic within the European Union now, is that if you have a core of countries like the Baltics, Poland, Sweden, Britain, who say, no, the sanctions ought to stay on until there's a real change in Russian policy, I think they have the ability to block EU policy on sanctions from changing. Now, what happens a year from now when the first sanctions come up for review in July and then a couple months later in September, we'll have to see then. But my guess is those sanctions can be kept on within the EU for that period of time.
Fiona, I have only one addition, very naive, because, well, I'm very naive in this area, but I have a recipe for Mistral. You know, according to the Russian information, and, well, you can, Georgia could initiate this initiative. According to our information, Mistral had to find its place of residence in the Far East, so Khabarovsk or Vladivostok, and be a kind of instrument of deterrence against one certain country. So my suggestion would be, you know, directed to the Japanese government. Let them buy Mistral and place it there, and it would be deterrence against the same country. Okay?
Well, there's an idea. I'm not sure. The Japanese government might be rushing to that, but lots of ideas. We have two questions here and then the lady over here, and I'll go back to the panel again. And again, if you could introduce yourselves and make the question short, I'll be able to get back to another round.
Thanks a lot. My name is Sevak Sarukhayam. I'm a Fulbright foreign scholar at Georgetown University. Actually, I have a question for Adrian Karamzin, about the pro-European parties and members of the parliament. What you mean saying pro-European? Because many of those people who are now for the membership of Ukraine in European Union, about 2 years ago, they were among the Yanukovych elite, one of the most corrupted bureaucrats in Ukraine. So is will to become a member of European Union enough for being called pro-European?
It's a very good question about what does that mean in this context. The gentleman here, and then the lady at the aisle here.
Thank you. Hi, David Colton, Two questions, one for Steve and one for Anders. The first question, Ambassador, is it time for us in D.C. to really begin to talk about political parties in the RADA and reform without recognizing what Ukrainian journalists are saying, which is that the RADA is the first screen behind which real political power, the oligarchs, continue to exert influence. And there are a number of commentaries in the Ukrainian press warning that reforms may take the shape of selective reforms, one oligarchical bloc versus another. And what are the indices that we as observers should look for in trying to see not only the theater on stage, but maybe what the director's cueing off stage? And for Anders, my question for you is this. In the early 1990s, when we did privatizations, it went well in Czechoslovakia with Klaus. The historical memory of culture and markets was strong. It didn't go so great, but okay, in Hungary. Poland, eh. And when we went to Nizhny Novgorod and Saratov in Russia with the IFC, it was a disaster, and that was just light retail privatization because the cultural memory of the Reformation of words that we take for granted, the Enlightenment, they weren't there. So when you call for a Marshall Plan, may I ask, is Ukraine really in a comparable position to Western Europe, which were fully developed societal structures devastated by war, but the cultural memory of what it meant to be a developed economy were firmly in place? And how comfortable, Anders, would you be about the suggestion of targeted, selective reconstruction efforts, specific funds targeted towards energy sector, targeted towards specific things that the West can get around and embrace without maybe falling into the miasma of, you know, are they really ready for something like a Marshall Plan? Thank you.
Thanks. Both very good questions. And then the lady here.
Leah Schwartin from Talk Radio News Service. This is for Anders, pretty much. But you mentioned a bit about that Ukraine might be trying to move towards the EU. Now, a couple months ago, the idea was floated that Ukraine might try to move towards a membership in possibly NATO. I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Thanks very much. So, Adrian, let's start with you on this question about what does pro-European really mean, and I'm sure that everybody else will have a thought about this. It's kind of a sort of a catch-all phrase, but, you know, can we pass that down as to what exactly is the content?
Sure. Well, you know, of course, that's an issue. It's easy to declare that you're a pro-European, that you want to have a European lifestyle, European economy. I think President Yanukovych himself talked a lot about Ukraine's European integration. So it's one thing to declare it and one thing to actually, you know, work in that direction to make the changes. And I think that's, you know, what this is all about, what this election has been all about. I think if you do look, though, at the numbers and the people, the names on these party lists, the top people, there really don't seem to be a lot of credible reformers, people that are, you know, really trying to make change in Ukraine. I would even just mention kind of the whole, I mean, we can't forget about the Maidan and the spirit of the people and what that meant, the commitment that people have made to that. And it's hard for me to believe that so many politicians could just ignore that in their approach to their work. I did happen to see a few weeks ago a talk show on TVI channel called Price of Freedom, and there was a whole discussion about why doesn't Europe understand we really want to be part of Europe? We are kind of the forepost. We're the easternmost border of Western civilization, if you will. And it just felt so heartfelt. So it's hard for me to believe that there isn't a whole new generation and a whole new group of people that are very, very strongly committed to.
Thanks, Adrian. And Anders, in addition to the very specific questions for you, you might also perhaps take on this issue, again, something that you know quite well about the role of the oligarchs, because that's not also a homogenous group by any means. And obviously there are oligarchs, and there are individuals, and there are groups that obviously stood behind the Party of Regions and many others. But, I mean, how do you see that playing out as well?
Yeah, I would say that the oligarchs in Ukraine have never been as weak as they are now. If you take the five big traditional oligarchs, four are down and out for various reasons. Three of them have lost a lot in Donbass. One has lost on the Russian sanctions, and one is standing firm. Poroshenko will have to take down the one who's standing, Igor Kolomoyskyi, who's now governor of Dnipropetrovsk. If he's going to prove himself, he has to prove himself. So this is a reason to hit hard fast, that the oligarchs are so weak now. Before somebody comes in and gains from the gas trade again. On the question here about privatization, I'm afraid that I totally disagree with the whole analysis. The problem with the former Soviet Union was that there was no clear break with the old system. There was no lustration. The old communist bureaucracy by and large stayed in power, apart from in the Baltic countries that we don't really discuss as former Soviet republics. And it was not the culture. If you have the same communists in power, of course you don't expect them to be good, but you expect them to transform the power into property as they did. It was not privatization that made them rich. The way of making money in the late 80s and early 90s, it was to buy oil for $50 per ton and sell it for $100 per ton abroad. Then you made a fortune on one shipping. And this is how virtually all the oligarchs in Russia became rich. In Ukraine, all the oligarchs in the 1990s made the money on gas trade between Russia and Ukraine. And recently, since 2010, it has been on domestic gas trade. That is the most corrupt business. This has nothing to do with privatization, or rather, privatization is the way of stopping it. So why was Ukraine so awful 91 to 94? Because there was no economic policy. The result was hyperinflation of 10,000% in 93, and that the gas trade took over completely. There was hardly any privatization at all. Big privatization in Ukraine took place in 96, and because it was so late, it was of somewhat worse quality than in Russia, but that turned out to be the only way you could privatize. The only successful big reform that Russia undertook is privatization. Therefore, anti-reformers are blaming everything on privatization, instead of blaming it on a complete lack of deregulation and a complete lack of fiscal discipline. Russia had a budget deficit of 9% of GDP from 93 to 98, and only the financial crash of 98 cleaned it up. And target selective projects, that's the best ground for corruption. Just look up on Skolkovo in Russia if you want to see how it doesn't function. It has cost lots of money and produced no results. So this is exactly what must not be done. I think that the NATO issue is more for Steve and for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Anders. Steve, do you want to comment on it? Lily, if you do have anything on any of these points, let me know.
On the question about the RADA and can it really be a vehicle of change, I think, or at least I hope I said, there is hope in the West, not necessarily an expectation. I mean, we're basically hoping that the RADA act in a different way from the way it's acted for most of the last 24 years. But I do think that there are two or three reasons to have some optimism on this. One is Anders' point here, which is today the oligarchs as political players are weaker than they've been since Ukraine regained its independence. Second, I do get the feeling that at one level, people like Yatsenyuk and Poroshenko, they do understand that if they blow it this time, they really are condemning the country to years or decades of failure. And then the third point is, Adrian mentioned this, the addition of maybe 30 to 35 civil society activists to party lists. And there's some really fascinating people here. One person who ran on, I think it was Poroshenko's party list, spent, you know, last week down in southern Ukraine campaigning against his party's candidate for the constituency because he said, this guy's corrupt. So there's 30 or 35 folks in there in that new parliament who are not going to be prepared to play business as usual. And that can, I hope, mean a lot of transparency if you begin to see the RADA act in the bad old ways. So yeah, the institution has a lot of changing to do, but there may be some reasons to be a bit optimistic. On the NATO question, it seems to me that President Poroshenko has been pretty clear. NATO, putting Ukraine on a NATO track is not on the agenda. And there are three good reasons, I think, for that. One reason, of course, is moving towards NATO is a usually difficult issue vis-a-vis Russia. But there are two equally important reasons. One is, if he were to articulate a policy of drawing closer to NATO, that's going to be a problem for him in terms of domestic politics in eastern Ukraine, and not just in Donetsk and Luhansk, but other parts of eastern Ukraine. It would probably be the most controversial foreign policy he could choose. So he doesn't really need that domestic issue. And then the third reason is, and I think the Ukrainians have probably figured this out, when you look at NATO today, there is no appetite within the alliance to put Ukraine on a membership track. And so you don't want to ask a question when you're pretty sure the answer is going to be no. So I think there are three reasons why Poroshenko's been basically signaling NATO, that's an issue for way, way down the road. Two other points. The ironic thing is that, though, for the first time since 1991, polls are actually showing that support for joining NATO within Ukraine is getting close to the 50% mark. And again, I think that's a direct result of Russian actions over the last 8 months. The other point I would make is that it's been, I think, pretty obvious going back to early June after Poroshenko became president that he's willing to sideline the NATO question. But there's absolutely been no evidence I've seen that the Russians have tried to pick up on that. You know, I'm not sure that's a big issue for the Russians. I think the Russians are actually as concerned about Ukraine proceeding down the European Union track as they are about the NATO track now.
Well, we'll be picking up on the EU very distinctly in the next panel, so let's lead them for something to talk about. But Lilia, do you have a comment on this?
Just one sentence about my mental problem now. you forced me to think to what extent Ukrainians are less European than Hungarians now, because Hungarians have allowed their leader, Orban, to build in Hungary a kind of, you know, replica of Russia, authoritarian regime with nationalistic longings. So, well, are Ukrainians less European? But definitely, Ukrainians are much more European than Romanians were in 1989 when they shoot Nicolae Ceaușescu and Yelena, because Ukrainians let Yanukovych go.
Another great thought to leave us with. There was a question here, and then down here, and then I'm afraid I'll have to cut this off and go back to the panel to not delay us from the next one.
Hi, Ken Yalowitz, Wilson Center. Lilia, could I be the devil's advocate for just a moment? You've outlined, you know, why, you know, Putin has done what he's done and all the various factors, how he's basically dug himself in. But you've also mentioned at the very end, you know, that Crimea is going to leave the headlines very soon because it's going to be a big economic, you know, basket case. You mentioned public opinion in two ways, that they don't favor a war with Ukraine and that they don't want to be isolated. When you add to that, no matter which way you cut it, the election in Ukraine, to me, is a loss for Mr. Putin. The vote was very clear on the direction that this country wants to go. I don't think there's any way that that can be dismissed. When you add to that the increasing effect of economic sanctions on Russia, the inability to borrow long-term, all the other issues that we know, is it possible, impossible, what, you know, that this may have some impact in the Kremlin, or is it hopeless?
Ken, thanks. Wonderful question.
Lily,
should I?
Well, let's just wait. Okay. There's one last question, then we'll come right back to the panel here. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Charlotte Beck from the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Thank you for the presentations. I also have a question for Ms. Shevtova. You described a little bit how for Putin it's actually very, very difficult to get down from this propaganda war that he has started. And I wanted to ask you what you think is the role of European actors in giving him that access strategy to kind of enable him a face-saving way of getting out of the confrontation. As you said, you know, he basically can't lose and he can't win. So, and how far do we need to give him that access strategy, and in how far is a very tough message towards him not useful, because again, you kind of need to be more less confrontational in order to give him that way out, because that's obviously a strategy that's been put forward by some European powers and some European governments to kind of, you know, reach change in the Kremlin through rapprochement rather than confrontation.
Well, thanks. I mean, both of those are related questions, so Lilia.
Well, very briefly, we could just continue during the interval. In fact, this is the question that you raised, that we are struggling in Moscow. It seems to me that even the close Putin's gang came to Russia. They do understand the nature of the losses. They do perceive that in Ukraine they have lost so far. At the same time, they will continue because, in fact, to get out of this pattern, patriotic mobilization, which gives 85% of approval rating, it's unbelievable, because every day they start with a red folder, how much I have today. And to lose 2% is a drama, is a tragedy. And to keep this 20, 25% for the next 4-3 years, it will be very difficult. So he will need some new threats. And I'm very much afraid that the new threat, if, for instance, you do not allow him to touch Narva, well, or Latvia and Estonia, could be the terrorism, could be terrorism inside of the country. We have a lot of inside traps, okay? There is another way to escape it. If the political elite, and it seems to me a significant part of the political elite, understands that Akela is wounded, that he cannot guarantee them the previous well-being. So that, in fact, the salvation for them is the regime change in order to save the system. Regime change means Akela has to go, okay? So, and it seems to me this will be at least one of the possibility to get out of this trap temporarily, because the system still has a lot of entrenched interest and a basis. And responding to your question, I fully agree with Anders and with Steve's recommendations. I would add a couple of more, you know, looking at the West. The problem is for Russian population, it lost the West as an icon, as an example to follow, due to Schroeder being working for Gazprom, etc., due to many things. So practice what you preach is very important for Russian population to find civilizational alternative. Regarding the toughness, I agree with recipes. You know, it seems to me that you cannot abrogate the sanctions, which is internationally legitimate instrument to de-escalate tensions, but sanctions never in the history returned the situation to the status quo ante. You have to think about it. And sanctions, it's tactic. Come on, it's means only. Sanctions could work within the strategy. And this was the strategy.
Well, actually, I think we should end there, because we're about to talk about the strategy at the next panel. So thank you very much to everyone in the panel for joining us, and thank you also to you as well.
Thank you for being here. Welcome back to the second session of our today's events on Ukraine's elections and their implications for both Ukraine, Europe, and the U.S., and of course, Russia. In the previous session, we had a quite insightful discussion about the Ukraine's domestic politics, how these elections are going to play out. In that context, this session is instead meant to provide you with some more insights about the implications of the elections for Ukraine's relations, in particular with the European Union, which is clearly emerging as the most important and most relevant foreign partner of Ukraine, but also of the implications of, you know, developments within Ukraine for the United States, and finally, last but not least, Russia. In order to do that, we have gathered quite extraordinary panel of experts, which I'm going to introduce you very briefly. But before that, I think I should first say who I am. My name is Riccardo Alcaro. I am a visiting fellow with the Center in the US and Europe here at Brookings. And I'll be, of course, moderating this session. So on my left is Rebecca Harms, who is the co-chair of the Green Group in the European Parliament. He is also a member of the delegation to the EU-Ukraine Parliamentary Cooperation Committee, and also a member of the same institution, of a similar institution tailored on Russia, into which, however, it seems Rebecca cannot any longer enter. So perhaps you may tell us something about that later on, Rebecca. Then we have Michael Lee, who is currently a fellow at the Transatlantic Academy of the German Marshall Fund here in D.C., but he was a director general in the European Commission for years. He is one of the main architects of the European Union's policies towards the neighborhood, both in the south and both to the south and to the east of the EU, but in particular to the east. Alexander Zastiev seats after Michael. He is an historian. He's a Ukrainian historian and a Fulbright scholar, currently based at the Cannon Institute within the Wilson Center. And finally, to the far left, to my far left, Samuel Charap, who is a senior fellow with the International Institute for Strategic Studies here in D.C. He is, of course, an expert in Russian and Eurasian matters, and those of you who have also an interest in such themes have certainly read something he has written on the topic. So, Rebecca, why don't we start with you, and I would kindly ask you to give us some brief an overview of how these elections in Ukraine are being viewed in the EU. What is the EU going to do about that? What is the EU's plan concerning Ukraine, and whether there is a strong or a shifting consensus on what the EU should do about Ukraine? You will have, I mean, each speaker will have about 8 to 10 minutes for their initial remarks. Please bear in mind that you will have time to elaborate in the Q&A session. Rebecca, please.
So I found it very interesting in the last panel that I don't know who said it, but somebody said that this new Verkhovna Rada is maybe the most European, pro-European parliament in and outside of the EU. And this means that the Ukrainian electorate is more pro-European electorate than the electorate in my country, Germany, or in Italy, or in France. So it's interesting. It sounds provocative, and I think it's worth to look into this as a European. I would agree that the vote on Sunday in Ukraine was in the result a very pro-European vote, but I tend to say it was more than pro-European vote. I think it was a pro-Ukrainian vote. It was a strong vote pro-democracy, pro-fundamental rights, pro-well-functioning state. And being pro-European in Ukraine has a lot of aspects. Yeah? It's not, from my point of view, not sufficient right now to describe it as a pro-European. But for the Europeans, it matters a lot what happened, because this vote is another moment in which Ukrainians decided to stick to the European way, in spite of many disappointments, especially also during the last year. And this nails, I would say, the European Union to their to their promises, which they have given over a period of I would say a decade, again and again, to the Ukrainians. And so for what is going to happen in the EU as a strategy towards Ukraine, it matters a lot to have a look and to be aware of what happened during the last 10 years in this very difficult relation, Ukraine-European Union. I don't know what's the situation in the United States, but in European member states, you can hear very often the idea that the EU has forced the Ukrainians into this way, onto this way, direction Europe or direction West. If you look simply to the facts, so what happened in the last 10 years until last Sunday, you find the opposite. So after 2004, after this stolen vote and the process of first or the second revolution in Ukraine, after 2004, the Ukrainians wanted not kind of association with the EU, they wanted membership. The answer of the European Union was not, yes, you will get membership, but the answer of the European Union was, okay, let's think about it. You will get an association agreement. Yeah? This came late. This came not after 2004. This idea came late, and it was Timoshenko in, I think, 2009, who started systematically to negotiate on such an agreement. We had the negotiations for a long time, for several years, until 2013. In summer, also the Party of the Regions, with all their prominent politicians in Kiev, negotiated the association agreement. And only in 2013, in autumn, it became more and more clear that Yanukovych would try to escape from signing the agreement in Vilnius summit. What did the EU do after this Yanukovych and his refusal to sign? The EU, from my point of view, at least in a certain moment, thought about escaping the association agreement. So maybe it's not that what the Europeans like to hear, but without the strong Euromaidan movement, without this new, very, very strong citizens movement, probably we would not have had the association agreement. So it was another time that Ukrainians, and now much more than in 2004, a wide movement of Ukrainians achieved that the EU stick to the promises they had given before. So 2013, 2014, during the worst situation on Euromaidan, EU had already left the scene in Kiev and had to come back after the sniper attack against Euromaidan to calm down the situation. And only after the annexation of Crimea, EU was ready to sign the association agreement. Why do I come back to this? I see this vote in this whole story among EU and Ukraine as another as another step to stick to this idea of EU and Ukraine deepening their relations. And I would say since Sunday, the chances that in Ukraine, the politicians, the Rada and also the government, the president are better prepared to fulfill the requirements of the association agreement after after Sunday, the chances are much better to really achieve what is already agreed in this association agreement. So you heard in the panel before a lot of things on reforms. I think most clear cut by Anders Aslund, and I would agree that he mentioned the most crucial issues for the reform agenda. And I would like to underline that my experience in Ukraine brings me to the position that so Ukraine is ready to go for deep reforms. Ukrainian citizens are aware much more than citizens of GDR after 89 or Polish citizens after in the early 90s. Yeah. Ukrainian citizens are really aware that they have to go through tough times. They have no fears for cold winters. They have the experience with this already. They really want to go for those reforms. The question is whether the West, especially the EU, is really ready for the assistance which is necessary beyond the transfer of money or the agreement on IMF rules, because I think assistance is really needed. And one thing what could be really easy is to whom we dedicate our engagement. So we have the new forces now, not only in the Euromaidan civil society movements across Ukraine, we have the new forces now also in the parliament. But the EU as such, yeah, normally tends to prefer to negotiate with the establishment, be it whoever, yeah, the establishment, the leaders of the state are the people we are negotiating with. On our tables, we are sitting with Mr. Poroshenko, we are sitting with Mr. Yatsenyuk. It's very easy because they are perfect in English. But if you look into these new political elites of Ukraine, be it Svetlana Zalentchuk, Mustafa Nayem, or Yegor Sobolev, you have also people who are able to speak English. They have very good skills. They could be a brilliant partner also for the Europeans. But the Europeans have to decide to take also those forces serious. And this is, I think, something where we have to change really our strategy. Coming back from Kiev, because I was observing also on Sunday the elections, I spoke with many people in the polling stations, and so they are prepared to fix all the problems around necessary sanctions. They know they need assistance on this, but the open question is how the EU will assist Ukraine to solve the problems with the war in east of Ukraine. So how the EU is really able to help Ukraine with Russia, or that Russia was ready to go to war against, or at least to back so-called separatists in this war. Russia was ready because of this trade agreement to do this. How we can fix it? So I am horrified by the idea that the sanctions will be weakened already now without nothing being achieved on the East. I think this should then be part of the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you very much, particularly for raising the issue of, you briefly mentioned it, of EU membership, which I hope we'll be talking again during the Q&A session. But let me turn to Michael. Michael, you are deeply knowledgeable about EU policies towards its eastern neighborhood. Why don't you give us a sort of a background of it, and why don't you give us your opinion about whether the EU should now more concentrate on the most urgent matters, leaving aside for a moment the issue of how EU-Ukraine relations should look like in the more long-term future, or whether you think that no short-term measure is actually going to be very effective unless it is already included in a broader, greater strategic design.
Well, thank you very much, Ricardo. I would like to take just a few minutes to consider how we got to where we are today and also how we should go forward, particularly considering that next week new leaders will take over in the European Union, including a new foreign policy chief, presidents of the main institutions, and for our new foreign policy chief particularly, a fresh look at Europe's relations with its neighbors, whether to the east or to the south, will be absolutely the top priority. Because if the European Union wishes to develop a common foreign and security policy, it can hope to have an influence first and foremost in its own neighborhood. And we have to get the policy right vis-a-vis this area if we're going to be a foreign policy actor at all. How did we get into this situation to begin with? In 2003, when we were a year away from enlargement, when 10 new countries were about to join the European Union, taking the European Union then from 15 to 25 member states, the European Commission began to reflect on what would this mean for the next group of countries that were not actually going to become members, either because they weren't European countries in North Africa, the Levant, or because they were not ready yet to consider the possibility of membership. And the Commission came up with a policy that was initially referred to as Wider Europe and then became the European Neighbourhood Policy. And the goal of this policy, enunciated 10 years ago, was to create a ring of well-governed countries, some people said a ring of friends, around the European Union, with the idea of creating a zone of stability and preventing the spillover of various forms of instability from the neighborhood into the EU itself. President Prodi, former Italian Prime Minister, Commission President at the time, said that we would be ready to offer these countries participation in everything except full participation in our institutions. There was a concern to give a message to Ukraine and the other countries to the east and eventually to the south that the big enlargement of 2004 was not turned against them, that Europe was not about to become a fortress, that, for example, the flourishing cross-border trade that there had been between Ukraine, Hungary, Poland, Slovakia would not suddenly come to a halt. And so the Commission devised a policy that was very much inspired by enlargement itself, by the experience of negotiating with Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and so on. The only difference, of course, was that we were not offering membership, which was, in fact, the main incentive that was given to these countries in Central Europe to reform. And yet we proposed a rather similar method. We suggested, essentially, that each of these countries, starting with Ukraine, also Moldova, and then when they lobbied to be included, the countries of the Southern Caucasus, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, and then on the insistence of President Prodi, the Spanish, the Greeks, the French, the Portuguese, who when you say neighbor, think first and foremost of North Africa, the inclusion also of North Africa and the Levant in this policy. And we basically invited each country, unreformed, we're talking about 2004, the Ancien Régime very largely in the East, before the color revolutions, and also in North Africa and the Middle East, to sign up to a whole series of far-reaching reforms. And in exchange for that, we promised to bring them into various EU institutions, policies, give them a stake in our internal market, as it was said at the time, give them some financial support, improve mobility for some travelers from these countries, students, business people, others who frequently visit our countries, a series of incentives. We also offered this initiative to Russia, but Russia turned round and said, thank you very much, this is not how we conceive of our relations with the European Union. We don't wish to take on your standards, your approach. We want a strategic partnership with the EU in which we're treated as an equal. The EU then spent 10 years trying to negotiate such a partnership unsuccessfully with Russia, and that more or less was the situation when the events that we're all very familiar with began last year. To start out with, it appeared as though Russia was not at all alarmed by the EU developing this neighborhood policy for the countries to the east. as Rebecca has said, it was not our intention to offer membership. And in fact, one of the motives for putting forward this neighborhood policy idea was to provide an alternative to membership. One or two member states were in favor of offering the ultimate goal of membership. Poland, Sweden, maybe the Baltics, and one or two others were ready to countenance this. But having just taken on 10 new member states, having the challenge of absorbing them, Bulgaria and Romania going to join a couple of years down the line, we didn't yet face the global financial crisis and the euro crisis, but there was no appetite at all for further enlargement. So what later became the association agreement and so on with Ukraine was meant to provide an alternative to membership, albeit that as European country, Ukraine and its neighbors were eligible one day for membership, but for the time being, this created a work program for them to demonstrate whether or not they were really committed to reforms. But of course, this was the period of the Orange Revolution and the backwash from that subsequently in the Southern Caucasus, with the exception of Georgia. The countries were not really very strongly committed to these reforms. In a new version of the old Soviet joke, people used to say that these countries pretended to the EU that they were ready to reform, and we pretended we were ready to take them into our internal market, make them part of our institutions, and so on. This was a rather unhappy experience during this 10-year period. There were a number of reasons, I think, why the policy has not succeeded, why the Economist 2 weeks ago commented that instead of a ring of friends, we have a ring of fire around the European Union, whether you look to the east or to the south. We were not consistent in this policy. We never enunciated a clear goal. Was it membership or not membership? Did we foresee something like the European Economic Area? Were we looking for a series of bilateral agreements? The member states and the EU institutions did not speak with one voice. The member states pretty much designated to the EU institutions the role of being the one wagging the finger, insisting on human rights, rule of law, democratization, basically while the member states got on with business as usual, whether in the energy trade or commerce in general, security issues. They pursued their national interests, as indeed they should, and expected the EU to be the defender of European values. One classic case had a minister in Baku from one of our member states lobbying for a particular pipeline project, the TAP project, while the very same day the European Commissioner in Brussels got up and attacked the Azeri government for having put two opponents in prison, as they are wont to do. So the member states and the institutions did not speak with one voice. The objectives were not clear. The incentives were not strong in the absence of an offer of membership. And it's little wonder that after 10 years, the effectiveness of this policy has been seriously questioned. In 2008, at the time of the Bucharest summit, when it became clear, as was said earlier on, that NATO would not expand, and also the Russian war with Georgia, Poland and Sweden proposed that this policy become a little bit more solid, a little bit more coherent. And this was the origin of the Eastern Partnership, to distinguish it from the neighborhood policy to the south. And the Commission came along with the concept of a new type of association agreement, a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement that was then proposed to Ukraine and the others, and that we spent 4 years negotiating. This is an extremely wide-ranging agreement, just to give you a sense of this. It is much more wide-ranging than the agreements with Poland, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia and others had been before they joined. It's not only complete free trade, but it's also a huge swathe of regulatory convergence when they have to take on our standards, our norms, competition policy, a whole series of flanking policies linked to trade. So it is an exceedingly ambitious model. It took 4 years to negotiate. It's been signed now, will be ratified. The implementation has been postponed by a year and a half because of pressures. It remains to be seen whether, as we hope, this instrument will prove the means to stimulate reform in Ukraine and in the other countries. The EU made a lot of mistakes, as did the United States and most of the international community, in handling this issue. in the run-up to the Vilnius summit when the agreement was due to be signed, and which precipitated the whole series of events leading to Maidan and everything that came later. People forget that it was the EU that was holding Yanukovych nose to the grindstone and was saying, we will not sign with you unless, and this was very much at the insistence of Mrs. Merkel, Yulia Tymoshenko should be released from prison. Selective justice was one of the weaknesses of the regime that had been very much criticized. And unless another series of reforms related to the elections and to some other criteria that the Commission had developed should be satisfied. Some people think that Yanukovych would never have signed under any circumstances and that he was just playing Moscow off against Brussels. But in any event, we provided pretexts if pretexts were needed. We also swallowed the narrative that was very much Mr. Putin's narrative, that the European Union was forcing Ukraine to choose between Moscow and Brussels. This wasn't really the case, certainly not in technical terms. This agreement, which is a very far-reaching one, was perfectly compatible with the existing free trade agreement that Ukraine had with Russia and with other CIS countries. It was not compatible with Mr. Putin's customs union or proposed Eurasian Union, and that, of course, was the rub in the end. So as far as the EU is concerned, the time has come to take a fresh look at this policy. It could well be that Ukraine to the east and maybe Tunisia to the south are the best candidates for carrying forward this policy and demonstrating a real commitment to democratic reform, the rule of law, respect for human rights, the principles on which the European Union itself is based, and that the mechanisms that we have put in place will turn out to be appropriate ones when backed up with the necessary assistance and support from the international community, the international financial institutions, and so on. When you look beyond Ukraine and perhaps Tunisia, you can really ask yourself the question whether these extremely ambitious and wide-ranging and demanding agreements are really the instruments most needed by Moldova. Well, Armenia has now rejected the prospect, or by some of the countries around the Mediterranean. So a one-year review of this policy will be instituted as soon as the new foreign policy chief comes in next week. There'll be elaborate consultations with the countries, with the member states, with civil society. And I feel confident that what will come out of it will be a much more subtle and differentiated approach, one that includes a strategic vision, one that does consider also the EU's relations with Russia and how these developments are perceived by Russia. We may be very critical, rightly, of Russia, but for a decade we've more or less ignored how these developments would be perceived, rightly or wrongly, in Moscow, and I do think that's a dimension that we need to take into account. And on that basis, after a thorough review, I think that the policy will be a much more differentiated one, a lighter one, a one that is much more addressed to the particular needs and capacities of each partner country than the policy we've tried to develop over the last decade.
Thank you, Michael. And again, I do see the logic of differentiating the EU's relations with its neighboring countries, particularly tailoring the offer of more or less integration, more or less cooperation, according to the willingness and the capacity, the willingness to move forward by these countries and the capacity of these countries to absorb change. The issue in my mind remains of whether, as you said at the beginning of your intervention, in the case of Ukraine, membership should be really brought forth and put on the table, if not immediately in the open, at least started to be discussed seriously behind closed doors. But before delving into this issue, let me turn to Alexander. Alexander, how is the EU's policy towards Ukraine, the EU's prospective policy towards Ukraine, perceived by these new political forces that have now, for the first time in Ukraine's history, taken power? And are now the new representative of the new Ukraine And do you see any particularly large gap between what the Ukrainians may expect from the EU and the EU can realistically provide them with?
First of all, I am very grateful to the Brookings for this interesting experience. To be honest, when I received an offer to speak here, I had some doubt because I am not an expert in the field. But when I received a list of potential questions to the debate, I felt that I want to express my opinion, even despite a lack of expertise and my terrible English. And in contrast to my colleagues who are real experts, what I will say is not an expert opinion, but an opinion of ordinary Ukrainian. However, I believe that today my view reflects the views of majority of Ukrainians. I'd like to put forward two very simple theses, which seem to be obvious to me, but not so obvious to some of my American colleagues. First, in the present circumstances, it is impossible to avoid conflict between the European Union and Russia if the European Union remains committed to its founding principles. And second, only a firm position and joint efforts of the United States, European Union, and Eastern Partnership countries may force Russia to abandon its neo-imperial ambitions. During the 7 weeks of my stay in the US, I visited several discussions and read a few articles about the Ukrainian crisis and its implications for the relations between the West and Russia. It caught my attention that some speakers and authors of the article said, okay, we should condemn Russia and support Ukraine, but Ukraine itself is a source of problems. Russia has legitimate interest in Ukraine. We should take into account Russian interests. We need to understand Russia. We should avoid a zero-sum struggle with Russia and so on. The same reservations are implicitly present in the potential questions I received for today's discussion. For example, is there an alternative to the emerging competition with Russia over the Eastern Partnership countries? How can a zero-sum struggle for the influence over EU's eastern neighbors be avoided? My answer is, I don't believe that Russia is innately hostile to the West and its values and will never accept genuine partnership. But as long as there is an authoritarian regime with imperial ambitions in Russia, I see no way to avoid the competition between the EU and Russia over the Eastern Partnership countries. It is quite clear that Russia will continue to make every effort to prevent the release of these countries, particularly Ukraine, from its sphere of influence. And it's also clear that Ukraine and other Eastern Partnership countries by all means will try to get rid of Russian control. Thus, under the present circumstances, the only way for the European Union to avoid the competition with Russia is to accept Russian domination over its neighbors. In other words, to allow Russia to do in this region what it wants. But it would be a betrayal not only to Ukraine and other post-Soviet states. It would be a betrayal, first of all, of the principles on which the European Union is built, because the Russian attack on Ukraine is indirectly an attack on the European Union and its principles of governance. I don't think that for the European Union it should be only be a contest for influence over its eastern neighbors and for displacing Russian influence there. It should be a struggle for the defense of the right of these countries to choose their path of development. It is clear that supporting them, the European Union has the right to demand from them compliance with those principles it considers correct. Thus, Ukraine and other eastern neighbors of the European Union must prove that they deserve the support. This struggle will not be a zero-sum game if the United States, the European Union, and its eastern neighbors are firm and consistent enough and act jointly. The result will be to preserve the independence of Eastern European countries and to promote in them the values on which the European Union is built. Of course, the most desirable result for these countries would be the full membership in the European Union. But for that, they should make great efforts towards economic, social, and political reforms to meet European Union standards. We cannot demand that the European Union guarantees Ukraine will become a member of the European Union, but we expect European Union readiness to admit Ukraine if it fulfills the conditions necessary for membership. The prospect of European Union membership is an important incentive for Ukraine to reform. In the absence of unified resistance, it is unrealistic to expect that Putin will stop the pressure on Ukraine, especially when the division of Europe and its domination by Russia is at stake. The next question: should the European Union be ready to discuss with Russia a new European order? Why not? I don't like the term new European order, which for me has neo-fascist connotations, but I do think that European Union and the United States should be ready to discuss with Russia the issues of mutual interest. But to discuss does not necessarily means to agree. Russia has the right to express its views on the issues of European Union relations with its eastern neighbors, but in no case Russia has to be allowed to deny its neighbors the right to make their own choice on foreign, external, economic, and security policy. In how far does Eastern Partnership need to take into account Putin's ambitions to create a Eurasian customs union? Is the next question. Again, we do need to take into account Putin's ambitions. But to take into account doesn't necessarily mean to agree with Thompson. Putin may create any unions he likes, but he may not force Ukraine and other countries to join them. And the European Union, in any case, should not agree with this. Should the European and especially interesting question, is Russia to be granted de facto veto over European Union membership? For what merits Russia should receive such a privilege? For the annexation of the territory of the neighboring country? For the hybrid war it wages against Ukraine? Does this mean that to get the right to decide on European Union membership, a country should not comply with European Union standards? It should only be military strong and aggressive state. I agree with Rutgers professor Alexander Motel, who writes, calls for understanding Russia, the Russians, and giving their views a fair hearing are little more than calls for abandoning one's own views. And I came to my conclusions. The recent parliamentary election proved that Ukraine today is more united and more European-minded than ever before. As observers recognize, Ukraine has political will both to defend itself against Russian aggression and to engage in radical reforms. To preserve and reinforce that will, Ukraine needs to receive adequate assistance, including military assistance, Dr. Michael Kaufman, from the European Union and the United States. This is my conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexander. Well, Samuel, you are, of course, quite an expert in Russian, in anything Russian. So I have two questions for you. The first one is pretty much related to the events which are unfolding right now, so Ukraine's elections. How do you see the Russian government react to that? What is your opinion of Russia's evolving strategy concerning the new political situation in Kyiv? And the second question is a more broader one and relates to something which Alexander has just said and which you hear quite often repeated here in the U.S. and not only in the U.S., Russia's actions in Ukraine are just part of a broader neo-imperialist or neo-imperial design. Do you actually see it that way, or you think that more nuance would be needed in order to really understand what happened in Putin's mind when he ordered troops into Ukraine?
Thank you very much, Ricardo, and thanks for the opportunity to speak here today. I'd like to start, though, I think, by taking a step back and perhaps even further back than Michael did, although it was a fascinating review of the 2004-2014 period, and just, you know, state something that I think is well known, but we shouldn't forget, that the institutional enlargement that was embarked upon in the early and mid-90s has transformed much of post-communist Europe for the better, and that outcome was far from inevitable in the early 1990s. And also, as the Arab Spring demonstrates, somewhat unique in its success. But I think it's also equally clear, and Michael touched on this a bit, that path had an inherent flaw from the start, and particularly in how it dealt with Russia and its neighbors. As Michael mentioned, the basic premise of enlargement of both the EU and NATO was that the rules were not negotiable, that aspiring members adopted the existing rules, or in the EU case, the acquis communautaire, in order to join the club. I've heard estimates, for example, in the case of the Ukrainian association agreement, it's about 90% of the acquis. The inherent flaw to that, that is the decision to extend the institutional status quo in Western Europe to Eastern and Central Europe, was that NATO and the EU could never fully integrate Russia, largely because, as Michael mentioned, Russia would never accept integration on those non-negotiable terms. They wanted a special partnership. But I think it's also true that that flaw, which was present from the mid-90s, wasn't unearthed until about the mid-2000s. And, you know, there were, particularly in the early part of the 2000s, after 9/11 and the increased cooperation between Russia and the West, arguably more substantive engagement between Euro-Atlantic institutions and Russia than with Russia's neighbors. But, of course, once the impossibility of Russia joining on Russia's terms became obvious and Western integration with Russia's neighbors accelerated, the broader relationship began to unravel. And despite successful cooperation, including with the United States during the recent period on issues from Afghanistan to nonproliferation to counterterrorism, we all know the list, Moscow still viewed Euro-Atlantic integration for Russia's neighbors as a threat. And to Russia, many Russians at least, this threat perception seemed uncontroversial as its neighbors were being incorporated into political and economic and security blocs of which it could never be a part. But as we've heard today, that policy has been interpreted as denying neighbors the right to make their own choices on foreign and security policy, reminiscent, of course, of the Soviet Union's attitude towards its satellites. And this remains today the fundamental chasm, that there is a regional integration agenda which, while not intended as an anti-Russian effort by its authors or by the states that aspire to it, Russia cannot and does not desire to join and treats as a threat to its interests. And the Ukraine crisis began in the context of this broader contest for influence in what used to be called the common neighborhood between Europe and Russia. And I think, in a way, without that, the context of that broader contest, it's hard to understand the events that followed. But, and we can get into the details of this, the tragedy that unfolded in Ukraine notwithstanding, the key question today is what to do about this conflict over regional integration between Russia and the West. As we've heard earlier in the first panel, the Western response to the crisis thus far has been threefold: assisting and deepening integration with the new Ukrainian government and Russia's other vulnerable neighbors, sanctioning and isolating Russia, and reassuring Central and Eastern European NATO members. Effectively, what this amounts to is a doubling down on the institutional enlargement policy, reinforcing previous gains and expanding the institution's farther east reach, that is, not literally membership, at least for now. It's clear that regardless of what the intention of the authors of this response was that Russia will see these efforts not as a response to its actions in Ukraine, but as an opportunistic continuation of the same post-Cold War policy that it has long decried as a threat. So, and while I appreciate the sentiments that Alexander expressed, it does sound like some of them as if they were written before this crisis and before we had a new reality created by Russia's aggression in Ukraine. The fact is that a newly assertive Russia is likely to continue to push back against enlargement, and this action-reaction dynamic seems destined to accelerate. And under these circumstances, providing new NATO security guarantees or even EU integration to ever more vulnerable states on Russia's border raises the risk of more conflict. Russia, in the last 9 months, has made it clear that it views keeping Euro-Atlantic institutions out of its neighborhood as a vital interest, while Europe and the U.S. do not view the security of Russia's neighbors as fundamental to their interests. So this same point has been made, or question has been asked, regarding previous rounds of institutional enlargement. That is, how would Russia react? And the assumption being not well. The difference today, however, is that Russia has demonstrated its willingness to act. And it's no longer a hypothetical. So what to do in this context? We need to begin by recognizing, I think, and sounds like Michael might be on the same page, that the post-Cold War policy of institutional enlargement, despite its successes, has run its course. The West's continuing insistence that the only path to stability and security in Europe is for Russia's neighbors to be absorbed into Euro-Atlantic institutions is now begetting threats to stability and security in Europe. Acknowledging that fact, however, does not mean that the West must accept Russian domination over its sovereign neighbors. Instead, new arrangements are needed that are acceptable to them, the neighbors, the West, and Russia. Achieving such an outcome is clearly theoretically possible, but it will require very politically difficult compromises. I think the West would have to accept that the model that worked so well in Central and Eastern Europe will not work for the rest of Eastern Europe, and that institutional arrangements will have to be acceptable to all parties, including Russia, in order for them to succeed. And Russia would have to strictly adhere to the limits any such arrangements would impose on its influence in the region and to forswear military intervention in the affairs of its neighbors. Now, this is not a desirable policy. It's a policy of necessity. And so, therefore, it's going to be difficult for any statesman to embrace in a public way. And it's abhorrent for many even to contemplate considering compromising the principles of enlargement that contributed to the successful transitions in Central and Eastern Europe. But the alternative, I'm afraid, is a confrontation with Russia that the West does not want in order to uphold principles that it ultimately will not be willing to defend.
Thank you. Thank you, Samuel. We now have around 35 minutes to have to recollect questions from the audience and have our speakers elaborate on them. So I think we have microphones here. So I will collect three questions first, and then go back to the speakers. Gentleman here, this row.
Brian Beery, Washington correspondent for Europolitics. Just following up on Mr. Lee's comment about the future EU policy needing to be more subtle and differentiated, and be especially interested to hear from the Parliament, what is the current feeling about what that should mean specifically in terms of is there an appetite for full membership for particular countries in the neighbourhood? And if not, what is the Parliament's current thinking on this?
Gentleman right there.
Sevak Saruhanyan, Fulbright Scholar at Georgetown University. Actually, I'm from Armenia, so about the future of Eastern Partnership, I have a question. Don't you think that Europe needs a different, differentiated policy toward the countries of the partnership? Because, for example, it is not possible to have the same approach to Armenia, which 90% depends on Russian gas, and have the same approach to Georgia, which has a zero dependence on Russian gas. So a different approach to the different countries, thanks.
And gentlemen over there. Yes.
David Colton with a two-part question. One is about the EU structurally as a geopolitical actor. One lesson, it appears to me, of recent events is that the partnership initiatives and the entire construct of neighborhoods, the common space, all these Brussels-based concepts were not fully shared and integrated down at the core member state level with respect to what it meant in terms of real geopolitical commitments. That is to say, Brussels was writing checks that the member states were not willing to cash. And so if that's a correct assessment, I'd be delighted to hear your views as to what measures might be taken to more closely integrate the EU as a responsible and integrated geopolitical actor. Second question, shorter. Although the EU, from an internal perspective, believed its initiatives going east were non-invasive and non-intrusive, by November of last year, unmistakably, Putin had made it clear he was playing a zero-sum game. $15 billion in cash to Yanukovych, okay? Nothing from the EU. Heavy discounts on gas, forgiveness of sovereign debt. These are classic, powerful, zero-sum geopolitical instruments, and there was nothing forthcoming from the EU. The tragedy is after Maidan, after Donetsk, after Crimea, the EU ponied up with about $15 billion in aid after the fact. So my question to you is, from a responsible geopolitical point of view, when November, it's clear that Putin is saying in skywriting language, this is zero sum, why didn't the EU match? In which case, then, the question for Yanukovych signing wasn't, I sign a piece of paper and go home to a bankrupt country, versus real concrete aid from Russia. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have two questions, basically, on the meaning of the differentiation, what does actually mean for EU foreign policy concerning the neighborhood, and one, a broader question about geopolitical relevance and the ability of the EU to act as a geopolitical player, and also a specific question on why the EU did not match Yanukovych, Putin's offer to Yanukovych November last year. So, Rebecca, who better than you about the meaning of differentiation, what the EU policy towards Ukraine or countries such as Armenia should be, and how differentiated they should be.
So first of all, I think if we are talking about mistakes which are in the responsibility of the EU for the situation we are in, I disagree with what you described as the major mistakes of the EU. I would say it. You hinted on a problem which I also see, that on the level of member states, the foreign affairs ministers or the heads of states, they did not follow carefully enough the European neighborhood strategy. Only when the tensions were growing around and in Ukraine, only when we saw the trade war opened by Russia against several of the countries in the Eastern Partnership, they woke up a little bit, but not enough. And in the end, it led to this so half-hearted situation in Vilnius, where they gave up on Ukraine, first of all, and followed only some of the other and mainly weaker agreements in the Eastern Partnership. I think the main mistake beyond not paying enough attention to the Eastern Partnership, and I don't know whether the wording mistake is really right. The main mistake was not to recognize how Russia changed. So this is something which still is in the making. So to really understand what is now the strategy of Putin and the people around him, And I'm really not ready to share the attitude that negotiating the ideas of Eastern Partnership and different agreements gives Putin the right to react how he reacted, because in a way I understood your speech as kind of excuse for that what happened and a kind of description of European mistakes which made it only possible what Putin did, or gave him the reasons to act like he acted. So I think we missed really to understand earlier what happened in Russia, and maybe we missed because our interests in well-functioning economic, especially energy and resource relations to Russia, our interests are so deep and so developed. And this brings me also to my idea that as long as we have not revisited the whole network in between EU and Russia, and have not developed our idea how to make an own European energy strategy without being that dependent from a gas import from Russia, we will not be able to deliver an own idea on how to agree with our neighbors in between EU and Russia. So this is it's very complicated. If you look, for example, now onto the urgency planning for EU and Ukrainian energy supply, you see it's mainly focused on making the gas flow from Russia to the West again go, and without complications. It's not at all focused about on an own European, Ukrainian, Eastern, or also including United States strategy. It's really still bound into all those things which made us so dependent. And I'm really suffering from the lack of ideas in Europe how to make it better. Considering membership, so I don't know who has listened to the speech of Commission's President Mr. Juncker, or next Commission's President Mr. Juncker, already elected or supported by the European Parliament. He did not decide to continue or to pick up the idea on having an own commissioner responsible for further enlargement. He explicitly said that for the next 5 years there will be no enlargement. I think this was a shock mainly on the Balkans, in the Balkans. You see also there certain distortions in Serbia and around Serbia, also based on new influence of Russia. And I think it was wrong that Mr. Juncker explicitly said no membership negotiations during the next 5 years. I understand the political reasons behind, but nevertheless, I insist it's the wrong signal towards the Balkans and also towards Russia. And for Ukraine, so I'm fed up with all the wrong promises we gave to Ukraine. I think the best promise also in the context of further possibilities for membership is to really work together in reforming Ukraine. So membership will be possible based on a reformed Ukraine. And so I stick to the European Treaty. So we are not a closed shop. We have the idea of being open. And I don't know why it should be possible for Bulgaria and Romania to join in 2008. I think it happened, or a little bit later. Why it should be possible for them to join, but not later on for Ukraine. It all depends on the reforms and on the will of the Europeans to resist to the Russian strategy that they, because they are ready to use military force, that they can stop this.
So, Michael, turning to you, is it really the offer of membership the only real powerful foreign policy instrument the EU has at its disposal to resist and push back Russia's influence over Ukraine?
Assuming that that were to be the EU's objective. I mean, let me respond on a number of different grounds. Certainly, first of all, on the membership story. Any European country that shares the values of the European Union, according to the treaty, may apply for membership. Nothing will change that. What Mr. Juncker was doing was saying what every official of the European Commission and member of the European Parliament has known perfectly well for a very long time. It was, as they say in French, just a constatation de fait. It wasn't announcing a policy. When you see how long the accession negotiations took with the countries that joined in 2004, when you see how long it took Croatia, which was basically 5.5 years of negotiation, there's no reason why it should take any less for Serbia. It's just a mechanical process, quite apart from all the fundamental reforms or any political influences being brought to bear within the country. So for Mr. Juncker to say there will be no enlargement before 2019 is just basically stating a fact that everybody knows. Now, it may give a certain political message which might not be well received in the Balkans, but frankly, it's nothing new.
Received in Russia.
The Russians also have an embassy in Brussels. They follow the affairs of the European Parliament, the Commission. They are perfectly aware of these kind of processes. That could hardly have been news to them. Turkey, which has been negotiating for membership for the last 6 years, has fixed its own objective for membership, if ever this were to become a reality, as 2024. If Ukraine were somehow or other, if the member states of the European Union were to accept to start the process with Ukraine, as of today, we're talking about a 12 to 15 year process by any standards whatsoever. So there is no way that EU enlargement, except as a distant encouragement somewhere beyond the horizon, has any role to play at all in what is taking place in Ukraine today. On the other hand, strong support from the European Union, the task force that's been set up in Brussels to help with building up administrative capacity, all the fundamental reforms, if the Ukrainian people and government and MPs themselves have a will for it, Europe is gearing itself up to provide that kind of support, and I think it needs to. If I could answer the question about foreign policy and member states versus institutions and so on, this reminds me a little bit of my feelings during my brief days as an academic when I spent summers on campus, and I used to think how wonderful universities would be if there were no students. Brookings is, in a way, the answer to all that, of course, because, I mean, here you have a university with no students. But how wonderful the European Union would be if it had no member states. And if only the European Commission and Parliament and Council could be the ones calling the shots. But, of course, this is not the case. And, in fact, what happens very frequently is that a problem in the world exists. The member states see that it exists. They ask the Commission to take an initiative, or the Commission takes its own initiative. The Commission cranks up a policy that it usually does on a fairly mechanical basis, on the basis of previous policies, which was certainly the case with the Eastern Partnership that was modeled almost entirely on enlargement light, without the goal of membership. The member states then endorse it in council conclusions. The parliaments have committees, they adopt resolutions, and then the member states forget about it. And they leave it up to the Commission to go through all the process involved while they get on with business as usual. And business means energy to a very large extent with these countries. And if we're to have any hope to have a meaningful neighborhood policy in the future, we obviously have to bridge the gap between the interest-based approach of the member states and the sort of value-laden approach they've delegated to the institutions. So the institutions need to become more realist. In any future approach to these countries, we do have to consider the kind of diplomatic realities that Samuel has been talking about. We have to make energy policy a core of the future neighborhood policy, because that's where our interests lie. And to the extent that the countries themselves prove genuinely interested in reform and democratization and all the rest of it, we should be forthcoming and provide support. So I think to be effective in the future, we need to find a midpoint between the traditional policies of the member states and the more idealistic policies of the institutions. Finally, just to clarify on mistakes of the past, I think one has to be able to recognize one's own mistakes if one is going to do better in the future. Mistakes were committed by the European Union. Mistakes were committed by the United States. The impression given by senior American diplomats that basically America was deciding who the key figures would be in the interim government, who would be the prime minister, and so on. This was a mistake. It was a mistake for Mrs. Ashton to go down into the Maidan, in my view, and join hands with people that she didn't know at all. And now, these mistakes provided pretext, nothing more than pretext. Mr. Putin is cynical and manipulative. He would have done what he wanted to do, probably in any event, under any circumstances. And they were no more than excuses or pretexts. I quite agree with that. At the same time, I think some introspection about the successes and failures of our past policies is necessary if we're to do better in the future.
Well, Alexander, do you want to add something about this issue of membership? Michael has clearly explained what the real prospects of a potential membership offer are. It is something which, at best, is well beyond the next future and well beyond the visible horizon. But do you think that having this perception that membership could be there and having some assurances by the European Union that membership could be on the table if reforms are actually kicked in is unnecessary? Of course it will help, but do you think it is a necessary condition for Ukraine to put itself on the path which in the previous session we heard is it is extremely, extremely difficult, really a daunting task?
Yes, I think the perspective of European Union membership is extremely important for Ukraine to reform. It's our hope. And if you please, I would like to react to what I heard from Sam and what I read in his article. Yes, I agree with in some aspects with you. You are quite right. But I think I would disagree with some of your theses. What is wrong is this way of reasoning for me. According to it, there are two sides which interest do matter. These are the West and Russia. And between them are small countries, including Ukraine, which interest don't matter so much and even could be sacrificed to the great goal of global security and stability. I don't think so. For me, it is way of thinking of the 19th and 20th century, and I hope the way of thinking in the 21st century must be other. I think the best way to achieve international security and stability is to recognize that every country, small or big, has its own interest and has the right to choose its path of development. And what does it mean to take into account Russian interest, Russian perception? Should the European Union have accommodate Putin's perception of the near abroad, Blizhnye Zarubezhye, as an exceptional area of Russia's interest? Or the Russian perception of Ukraine as a part of the Russian world? Or the perception of the very existence of Ukraine as a historical anomaly? Or the perception of Europe as decadent, homosexual, and so on? And of Russia as the last stronghold of high spirituality and morality? The questions are rhetorical, but they are exactly the ones we should be asking about Russian perceptions. I believe that Europeans must have their own views on these issues and defend them. And I can't discuss the problems of European Union because I repeat, I am not an expert, and I am not a citizen of European Union so far. But I remember that 2 days ago, Timothy Snyder, answering his own question about the West options in connection to Ukraine crisis, said that the West, in fact, has two options, to be and not to be. I understand this. To be means for the West to remain true to its own principles and not to compromise them. This means, in particular, not to allow Russia or other country, including the United States or any other Western power, to return the world to the age of empires. George Soros has expressed this idea in other words. The European Union would save itself by saving Ukraine. And in this case, I agree with both Snyder and Soros. Thank you.
Sam, do you really think this is the case? The West should be or not to be, and that means should confront or appease Russia? This is the only option the West has?
No, I don't see it in those terms. Just to respond to what my colleagues said here, I actually think quite the opposite in my view in terms of the interests of the countries that weren't in those two categories of the West and Russia. It is Ukraine which will suffer the most as a result of the continuation of the trend we're on. It is Ukraine that has experienced war. It's Ukraine that's experienced territorial annexation. You know, the West hasn't experienced those things. So frankly, it's callous, in my view, to the, you know, lives and livelihood of Ukrainians to suggest that continuing on with the status quo will lead us to a better place. So I don't see this as about excluding Ukraine's interests. It's about, in fact, taking them into account. A principled position often leads to undermining of those same principles, in other words. Then there's a question about, in my view, about what the alternative is, about the path that we're on right now and where it's leading us. War in Ukraine, a new Cold War in Europe. If we are prepared for this kind of a confrontation, I'd like to see the resources put behind it. I'd like to see it become the kind of national project that the Cold War was. Otherwise, it's, you know, here today, gone tomorrow, now we have ISIS and Ebola. And frankly, I don't get the sense that that political decision makers have been honest with their publics about what it would cost to resource the effort that they're outlining. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. A round of questions. Gentleman over there, then there in the back. And 3 and 4, then also Steve.
All right, thanks. Michael Coughlin from Wilson Center. Work with Alexander. Two questions. The first one is just kind of want to get a sense from the panel to what extent they do agree with George Soros' article called Wake Up Europe, about that Russia does pose kind of an existential threat, a challenge to Europe in Europe, and that there have been all these other activities, and that essentially Ukraine is not a conflict between European policy and expansion of Western security framework, economic framework with Russia, but there really is an existential conflict between Russia and European Union, and Russia's working to undermine the European Union. I wonder, I've heard this several times, and I'm not sure to what extent that's true, and to what extent we're kind of fitting facts in order to write history looking backwards from the moment we've arrived at today, right? Different people, including Tim Snyder, paint a very compelling narrative, but a narrative full of contradiction in our sort of postmodern image of Russia as nefarious and incompetent, as ideologically proto-fascist and cynically without ideology, as, you know, a weak state that at the same time is an existential threat, the most powerful military alliance in the world. You know, it's hard to rectify some of these. The second question to you is a lot shorter than what I just said, which is,
how can you find a bridge between more realist views maybe of people like Sam and me, and I commend Sam for saying things that makes people shake their heads in this town, and people with more values-based views, both of which are valid, because I kind of see this as a choice of either you sacrifice Western values on the altar of compromise and pragmatism with Russia, or you sacrifice Ukraine on the altar of supporting Western values. Because one of these two is not likely to survive. In a compromise with Russia, Western values can't survive. And in a purely values-based pursuit of we will confront Russia, no matter what the costs are to Ukraine, Ukraine is not likely to survive. And I'd like people to answer that.
Thank you. Was a question over there? Yes. Then here in the second row, and then Steve.
Kyle Scott from the German Marshall Fund. Sam raised, I think, a very good question about the resources needed. He was talking about to wage essentially a new Cold War. But I'd like to focus it on Ukraine. The first session, we heard about all of the problems that Ukraine is facing, even with this new government. A new Marshall Plan was talked about. Does the European Union have the will, the capacity, and the agility to bring the sort of resources to bear in a short period of time to help Ukraine throughout the next year, not talking about some sort of association process of decades, but the next year or two, which is really, I think, the crunch time for this new government? Thank you.
Over here.
Yes, I'm Andris Razans, ambassador of Latvia to the United States. First of all, thanks so much for two excellent panels today on Ukraine and a little bit on Eastern Partnership. So we are preparing next EU Eastern Partnership Summit in Riga next May, and definitely there are more questions that should be still answered than we actually could even imagine. I didn't want to ask a question, but I was a little bit provoked by what I heard. Because, well, my country joined the EU in 2004. The process of, approximation of EU legislation, everything that took place in the 90s was quite a long and painful. But from our experience, what perhaps I have quite a quality to say about, what I can say is that what really matters in these situations, especially what we see in Ukraine today, and in Moldova and in Georgia in particular, it's not enough just to have nice strategy. And it's very clear that any kind of approximation with the EU will take years. We are not speaking about 10 years, maybe 15 years, etc. But that's a question for Ukrainians and Georgians to answer whether they would love to take this route or not. It's not for EU or not for anybody else to recommend. If Ukrainians are ready, well, they should proceed. And they should be allowed. But what really is missing is really perspective. And for us back in the 90s, this perspective meant a lot. Because membership means a lot of sacrifices. The government should take very painful steps and policies that should be introduced. And the public opinion electorate should support these policies without having a knowledge what kind of gain people will get after this very painful and difficult period. It's very difficult, really, to develop any kind of relevant policy. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to kind of follow up on Mike's question and push a little bit, Sam. But first, I agree with two or three points I've heard you make here. One is, I think you're right. Russia cares more about losing Ukraine than the West cares about gaining it. Second, I think to the extent, and I don't think we're in a new Cold War, but to the extent that you have a greater U.S.-Russia confrontation, it will make it more difficult to pursue issues where American and Russian interests converge, Afghanistan, Iran, strategic arms control. And the third point is, I think if you're going to have a settlement that will allow any degree of normalcy in Ukraine, at the end of the day, the Russians have to buy into it because the Russians have so many levers, not just military, but economic energy to disrupt and make life difficult in Ukraine. I wasn't, though, fully comfortable with your point where you said, well, by reaching a settlement, we're sort of putting Ukraine's interests first. I mean, because I think it's really a Ukrainian decision if the Ukrainians are prepared to, you know, continue this fight. But I guess the question I would ask would be, how far
are you prepared to go, or how far should the West be thinking of going in terms of making compromises about Ukrainian sovereignty in order to find a settlement? Because where I get worried here is when I look at things, again, going back to June and July, that were being said by President Poroshenko, where he was talking about NATO's off the table, decentralization of political power, pushing some authority out to the regions, status for Russian language. He was putting things out there that I thought responded to at least some stated Russian concerns, but I never saw an effort by the Russians to pick up on those. So how far should the West be willing to go in terms of making some compromises that are ultimately going to be about Ukraine in order to try to find a settlement?
Thank you. We have slightly more than 5 minutes, so I would kindly ask all speakers to be really telegraphic. Sam, you want to start and respond to Steve's question?
Sure. The kind of negotiation that I was talking about was really not about Ukraine or Ukraine's sovereignty, and I don't think there should be any compromise on any country's sovereignty. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about regional integration and its future in Europe and Eurasia, and whether there can, when common, whether or not common ground can be found. So I guess that's how I'd answer that more narrow question. I mean, negotiations might fail, but I have confidence in the United States and maybe a little bit less so, but enough in the European Union that we know what our principles are, and we're not going to, you know, forget about them just like that. So that you know, diplomacy is not just about compromise, but by the way, compromise, you know, in the context of international relations is sort of how you get to a better place usually. It's not. It's about finding a new way forward at critical moments and critical junctures. So I don't see it as this choice between compromising our principles or sacrificing Ukraine. You know, let's see what that negotiation looks like first. And if someone can show me that we tried everything everything possible, and the only thing that would get us, you know, peace was selling our souls, you know, then I'll buy that dichotomy. Until then, it's an untested proposition. And that, frankly, gets me back to something that was said in the first session, which is that what other tools do we have? Well, we do have diplomacy. And so it would be nice to see some more of that, too.
You wanted to pick up on something?
Yes. Want to react to what Michael said. In no case I want to sacrifice Ukraine to the altar of European values. No. But we simply have no other choice than to fight for these values. It is for us not only the question of prosperity or independence, it is for us a question of survival of Ukraine. Thank you for sending me the full version of your article. And I want to quote only two sentences. Lethal weapons from the U.S. combined with the arms and equipment Ukraine will undoubtedly receive from sympathetic European neighbors like Poland could easily lull the elites into believing they could prevail in a limited war against Russia to regain the separatist region. And other sentence. Weapons cannot alter the fact that Ukraine will not defeat Russia today or tomorrow. I agree with this, but for me, this way of thinking is based on two false assumptions. The first assumption is that if you don't provoke and irritate Russia, Russia will not respond with aggression. It is not so. In February, in March, there were no provocation against Russia. There were no threat, real threat to ethnic Russian and Russian speakers in Ukraine. But this didn't prevent the capture of Crimea and the invasion to Donbass. So if Putin really want to go to war, he will did it, even without any provocation or a real danger. And second false assumption is the view of Ukraine as the silly child which should not be given these sharp tools because it can hurt itself and other children. it also false assumption. Contemporary Ukrainian leadership can be blaming in different things, but in not in the absence of realism. And I think if United States really consider Ukraine as an ally, it should not consider it as a silly child. This is my response. In contrast to former Georgian President Saakashvili, contemporary Ukrainian leadership is much more realistic.
The question was asked whether whether Russia poses an existential threat to the European Union. No, it doesn't. I think Russia's policy vis-à-vis the West in general is mainly a sort of negative foreign policy to try and prevent us achieving some of our objectives, because on the whole, Russia knows that it cannot achieve its own objectives positively. So putting a spanner in the works is very largely their approach to us, and I think we can deal with that. Ukraine has been a partial exception to that because of its willingness to use force. What is Russia's objective in Ukraine in the medium to long term? I think the analysis that suggests that they will be content having annexed Crimea with a frozen conflict seems likely, hoping that Ukraine will then be sufficiently unappetizing either to the EU or NATO, that we won't want to take in a new source of instability at even some beyond-the-horizon moment. That's how I read Russian policy, but I have no inside track. There are others here who know it far better than I do. I mean, Carla's question about resources. Let's be clear about the scale of the resources. Eventually, after the Maidan, we, together with the IMF and so on, came up with a package of 17 billion, which, as somebody pointed out, we weren't willing to do earlier on when Russia came in with its 15 billion. The first bailout package for Greece was 170 billion, and there might be another bailout required for Greece. Let's not forget that the European Union is still going through its own existential struggle with the Eurozone crisis, which is not over and which may well predominate the next 5 years still. And therefore, the amount of time and energy we have for foreign policy of any sort is likely to be somewhat limited, although I do think that... So the answer to the resources, no. But what we can do is what we do best, which is to come in with technical assistance, with support, with institution building, with civil society programs, with twinning, and all of that to bolster the efforts of the Ukrainians themselves. But we will not be the key player in assuring Ukraine's macroeconomic stability. Finally, to the ambassador, I agree entirely that the accession perspective was absolutely crucial in Central and Eastern Europe and in Latvia and its neighbors. And it made those difficult and painful reforms possible. And being a member also, I think, helped Latvia through the crisis of the last few years, where it made almost unprecedented efforts and is now back in a much more healthy place than it was some years ago. It would be highly desirable, of course, that such a perspective be given in Riga next year. But once again, looking around the member states, looking at the euro crisis, thinking also of the point of view of member states more distant from Central and Eastern Europe, who have other preoccupations, it seems to me that in the same sense as at Thessaloniki, we gave a perspective to the Balkan countries, I personally would be, I wouldn't want to predict that that would be the outcome. But we can give encouragement in various forms, and we can come in with all kinds of concrete types of support and assistance.
Becca, you want to pick up on the issue of resources?
But so the mistakes in the rescue strategy towards Greece or other countries in crisis in the EU should not be the reasons to commit more mistakes in countries outside of the EU. So I would really doubt that this link is a fair link, what you are doing. And I know that we are not out of the crisis, but I think fighting for deeper economic integration and for an economic idea for the EU internally that goes beyond the austerity plan for Greece is the one thing. Yeah. So to act with responsibility in the neighborhood of the EU is another issue. And so to recognize that Russia puts new threats towards the EU, I think is also a responsibility which we have towards our citizens. And for me, so since I try to follow the change in Russia, since I try to take serious this idea on Eurasia, yeah, I think it's close to non-compatible with my ideas on European Union, because Eurasia is an idea which stands for non-democratic development, which stands right now for an authoritarian approach in the States, and which also sees one nation, Russia, leading a wider range of states in the East. And so this is not at all compatible with the idea of the European Union, and it's also not compatible with the idea of the Ukrainians I know very well, and other citizens in other neighboring countries, because they want democracy. As I said, the vote last weekend was not only a pro-European vote, it was a vote in favor of democratic development. And this excludes, for me, the idea to say, okay, we make Ukraine and others a kind of buffer countries in between Eurasia or Putin's empire and the European Union. It's about democracy, and I agree with all those contributions which said that Ukraine and other countries, but first of all now Ukraine, matters for the good future of the European Union.
Thank you, Rebecca. And we're already out of time, so with that, I close today's event. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to the speakers for the intervention.